All right, I think we're, if you're trying to follow along, and I apologize, we don't, all the slides don't all match the questions and vice versa, and I know we're going in all different directions as we have the discussion, but I appreciate it. I appreciate the discussion. Where we are now, we've kind of talked a little bit about character, some ideas about decision making, and how that might be done, and now I want to apply this in particular to the role of husbands and fathers, and then maybe a specific, maybe a deeper dive into discipline and what's behind it. So I need to talk a little bit about why we marry. And having done the little pyramid thing, probably gives some idea of what this is going to say, right? What is the purpose of marriage? But I want to talk about what the purpose of marriage is not. And again, I think we're just in some type of an ideological conflict, really, with the world. So I think the point that the theory that most would follow with regard to what marriage is about is it enables romantic love to flourish. I honestly get quite confused. There are co-workers and others who they decide to get married, but they've already lived together for quite a while, or they've been divorced and all these other things. I'm never quite sure what's the point of that. Why are you doing that? I think the only answer might be, well, it's kind of it's a further step in maybe helping romance flourish or something. And if the romance doesn't flourish, then there's really not much point in that, I guess. But, you know, in the Bible pattern, there was a kind of a sequence where there was a betrothal, which to me is the best I can tell by reading the law of Moses, was as binding as marriage. So if you had an affair outside, or whatever you wanted to call it, as a betrothed person with someone else, you had the same penalties of a death as if you committed adultery after you were married. So it almost seemed like that commitment point was really a precursor long before there was what we now call the consummation and all that of a marriage. And then after a while, there was an actual wedding ceremony. And then after that, there was the sexual relationship. And maybe after that, especially if it was an arranged marriage, you might actually fall in love, right? I don't know. Maybe that was the sequence. We've kind of flipped that whole order around, haven't we? In fact, we've almost pulled sex ahead of falling in love. There's this casual thing about it. I mean, why not, right? It's just something to do. What is that term, friends with benefits or something? It's pretty terrible. But then, at some point, you have more, a little bit more of a romantic situation. But the wedding is way down here, and I wonder what it is, really. But the idea is somehow maybe it culminates. It's the culmination of a bunch of other romantic things. I think another thought is that marriage is about personal fulfillment and security. I need someone to spend my life with. Maybe if my ups and downs, this person can level out those crises, perhaps. You marry somebody who's with status or with beauty or something, maybe I get a sense of accomplishment. I think that's always been the case that, you know, single women who don't find a husband in the Bible, that was not a good thing. So maybe that. Personal pleasure or convenience. Maybe affluence or financial security. Someone needs a husband to support them, or a wife, in some cases in our world, a woman who will support me. Social expediency, maybe, increasing my status. Ensuring success. Now we have children, maybe. I have to have a commitment of some kind. Maybe I want to have children and live out the ambitions that I could not carry out for myself through them. Maybe it's really just about improving the condition of the human race. It's an argument I'm tempted to make. We have a society that's long since left stable marriages behind. It's going to tear up this nation. It's going to be terrible. You know, there's all these fatherless boys that end up being criminals. And we make this argument, right? So maybe the purpose of marriage is to make society better, protect us from the anarchy that's likely to follow when we don't have stable family relationships. Is that the purpose of marriage? To keep our society? What is it really? I have a couple of verses that might be helpful. 1 Corinthians 7. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For how do you know, a wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, a husband, whether you will save your wife? We mentioned this in the morning session, but this kind of steps outside the whole business about romance and happiness and stability and all that other stuff, and just says, you know, maybe there's a reason to hang with this guy, even though he's not a Christian. It's not all that helpful, maybe not even all that pleasant, but you might save him. And he basically said, and so 1 Peter 3, likewise, wives, be submissive to your husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up with great career motives and good opportunities to, you know, be well-rounded citizens and so on. It's the training and the admonition of the Lord. It's the purpose for the father-child relationship. Interesting passage from Proverbs. We'll bring this up again before we're done, so we probably should just read it. It's an interesting pair of Proverbs. They're put back to back. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, I think that might be NIV, I'm not sure, he will not die. I don't know if that's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. He's not going to hurt him, right? Next verse. You strike him with a rod and you what? You rescue him from death, right? Sheol representing death. So it's not, he won't die. In fact, better than that, you actually save him from dying. Interesting pairing of those proverbs. And that is the goal of that discipline, is actually to save him from maybe some spiritual death. And then 3 John, I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified the truth was in you. Just as you walk in the truth, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Obviously not literally children, but in a family, but still that's the greatest joy about anybody, is that they have found a way to walk in the truth. So, if you had to summarize, what might be the purpose of the family in the ideal situation in God's design? What would it be? Sorry, I can't.
Godly offspring.
Godly offspring. Or you could say to save them, to bring them to God in some way. I mentioned before those three mysteries, maybe. What does it mean to be in the image of God? What does it mean to be male and female and to be one flesh? And then maybe what does it mean to be fruitful and multiply in that early part of Genesis. And maybe those all are understood as we read the Bible story to say, really, maybe we are helping God bring many sons to glory in having children, forming families for that. This will look familiar, so I won't have to spend as much time, but it's a little narrower view of the pyramid. If your life is built on pleasure and sex is a source of pleasure, marriage finds its foundation in those two things, right? And you might also have other relationships that are providing the how, right? Reading upward, the how for you get the pleasure that's there. These decisions, you can see the disadvantage of this. One of the things that's kind of important to me to think about is, if you're building marriage on romance primarily, how stable are romantic feelings day to day? You know what I'm saying? And really, even year to year, if you have a health problem, right, or you have some type of maybe some other, you know, like dementia, or maybe you have other social problems or whatever, I'm going to tell you that romance is going to come and go. And if you build the marriage on top of the romance, you've kind of got it upside down. You've built the stable thing on the unstable thing, so to speak. The volatile thing becomes a pretty poor foundation. Here's another view. Pleasing God. Marriage is the help, the how, to help me in serving God. Romance finds its meaning only in the stable, firm, committed, logically, committed. I'll say that again. Marriage. Now, romance is in that setting, not some volatile setting. And then I actually think the sexual pleasure finds its cocoon, its stable base in romance. And I don't know, because you're not married, I'm telling you, those upper blocks up there, they're a little bit volatile. They come and go. You know, sometimes folks are not in the mood, or I don't know how to say these kind of things, you know, in a way. But do you understand that? So it's a great thing. It's a great blessing when they're there. And the point is that these stable things below are the things that guide that. And what you end up with is you have the stable standard underneath. You have some relationship that exists way beyond just this providing pleasure as its only purpose. And so the marriage is based on more than physical comfort, and it puts the sensitive, powerful emotions. I always kind of think about this. Somebody who is a fighter pilot that I knew, he was just saying, you got to understand what it's like to fly. It's just like strapping yourself to the most powerful motorcycle. He thought I hadn't ever done that, you know, but I thought about that. You know, a motorcycle, big engine, some of you probably had that experience, right? It's exhilarating. It's unbelievably, you know, thrilling to just pull back on that you know, throttle and feel the G's and all that. And that powerful thing, just think about it. If it's not directed in the right direction, the damage it can do, which is kind of counter to the pleasure or whatever, the excitement it can provide. And I think both of those apply in the romantic and the sexual relationship. Enormously powerful. You're in the motorcycle, right? But if it's not aimed in the right direction and handled responsibly, as they say, it could be a great source of damage as well. And that's kind of what I was trying to say here. So here we are. I think we already know these answers. We've memorized some of them. In the beginning, this was the case. And for this cause, that Adam had gone through all this to have this helper suitable delivered to him from his own bone, right? So they're one flesh. And this is quoted three times. I think you know where those are now. We've learned them separately. What are the three times in the New Testament it's quoted? The two shall become one flesh. Matthew 19. And the point is? Yes, that's right. Do you see the point of that? You have a body, you don't cut your arm off, or you don't split your own body. It doesn't make any sense. It dies. It's cruel. I mean, in fact, I guess Malachi's language is it's violent when you do that. And so you don't separate. I don't know if that's the first one that comes up or not. No, it's to the Ephesians. So one flesh. What's the message in Ephesians that one flesh kind of mystery in some ways is used to teach in Ephesians? Read the text. Yeah, that's the idea. I do this occasionally, but it's accidental. Get a hammer and just smash my thumb over and over. I don't do that. Why? No man ever hated his own flesh, but he nourishes and cherishes. And if my thumb is hurt, all the other parts of my body kind of rally to make cared for and all that. And what he's saying is if your wife is your own body, that you would never do harmful things. And you would do everything to save and nourish and so on. So the application is love and sacrifice. We just talked about that one. It's all one thing, so how can you split it up? And that was Jesus' answer to the questions about marriage and divorce. But this one in 1 Corinthians 6, we mentioned that one. It has to do with teaching on fornication. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Now you see what he's saying there. That in the context of one flesh, there's this sense that when you do the sexual act, there's some union that in this case is inappropriate, right? So that maybe that's definitely a part of becoming one flesh, no doubt. Certainly not. Or do you not know that he is joined to harlot as one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. He who is joined to the Lord is what? One spirit with him. And so maybe there's more than just the physical act. I think there's some sense of agreement, of consensus. In other words, I have joined myself to this harlot. I am stating some type of an agreement with that action, with that sin, with that form of life. And who else have I brought into that agreement? That's one spirit with the harlot. I've kind of brought the body of Christ. And he's saying you're not doing it. It just can't be done. How could this be possible? He's saying. It's a little bit like, you know, how can light and dark be mixed together? They don't mix together. And he talks about being unequally yoked. Is what fellowship does light have with darkness? It just doesn't work. So I would reason from that this one flesh also includes not just simply the sexual act, but also an agreement, some type of a purpose and action union. I think all of that's involved in what maybe one flesh would be. So very important from the very beginning of time, that's what's there. So here are some of the roles. Head of the woman is the man. 1 Corinthians 11, not necessarily narrowed down just to the husband-wife relationship. Wives are to be submissive. Husbands give honor to the wife as a weaker vessel, and so on. You kind of see these commands. But I wonder if there's more to the story than just that. So looking at Ephesians 5, where he says, I am speaking concerning Christ in the church, and there's this great mystery. Here's kind of some of the reasons for that. Look at all the things that the husband is required to do. And I've put these on a better chart here where I've put these up there. And I'd like for us to think practically about each one. Is there a place in the lesson for this? I can't remember if I left. Yeah, it's kind of question. It's the third thing called Christ's example of headship. And I'd like to talk about each one. Maybe y'all would like for y'all to talk. What does it mean to be the head? And if you look over Colossians 2, it actually suggests that it is from the head that the nourishment and the health comes. It's from the head that growth occurs. If you look at Colossians 2:19. That's referring to Christ in the church. What is the responsibility of a husband to the wife as a head? Once again, from Colossians, I'm going to kind of steer us a little bit away from saying it's the person, the thing in charge. The head gives the orders and the arm obeys. I think there's more than that implied here. Read Colossians 2. Is there some sense in which a husband causes his wife to grow? That she flourishes as a result of that connection? Is that a possibility? Y'all are playing me out. It's after lunch. You gotta. If I don't wait long enough, I won't get the answers. I'll give you a hint. Maybe you don't know how these answers are supposed to, what they're supposed to look like. I think there are some habits that you develop to play these roles as a husband. I believe that one of the roles regarding, and these are in the order of the text, but is it possible that you would help your wife grow? Now, I don't mean by that you give her assignments and you're her, you know, as far as, you know, now study chapter 7 for tomorrow night and we'll come back and see what you've learned. I don't mean it that way, but I've had this experience, maybe you have too, where your wife is growing to be a servant of the Lord as well as you are. And it might be not just rearing the children, but it might be teaching classes. It might be counseling other women. It might be taking on some other role of service for other people that she's never done before. This may surprise you. Women are not born knowing how to do all the stuff that they do. I don't know where they all learn it. I think they learn a lot from other women. Is there a possibility you could encourage your wife to take on a new challenge that she's not really comfortable with, but she's capable of? I know there's some women that have never taught a class before, kids' class. Why don't you teach it with them? Why don't you help them do the preparation? You know, or find a way to pair them up. Give them encouragement. Go over the stuff with them. Help them develop material. Get them going as a kind of a starter kit, so to speak. And then get them going on. I think the development of our wives, and I don't mean as some type of a supervisor or boss over the work. I mean as an enabler, an encourager, a coach, exhorter, a cheerleader, something to say, you can do this. You can do this. This will be a little hard for me to get through. So I tell you, I'm getting old and my testosterone has gone away. And so I get emotional, but I'm not really embarrassed about it. It just kind of gets in the way of stuff. You young guys, it'll happen when you get older. I don't know what it is, but you know, you get these chemical changes and you get more emotional. I don't mind, but anyway, so that's going to happen. So he saves her. Now, in the case of the church, we're saved from sin and from the condemnation. But is there some sense in which a husband might save his wife from negative consequences in her life that maybe she deserves because of something she's done? That you could take the blame? We'll find the money. It's no big deal. You know, whatever went wrong, something like that. Or there's some embarrassment that you help overcome. As opposed to you get what you deserve. You made the mistake. You live with it. You know, you give up the money, whatever. And so I do think there's some place in which we ought to sacrificially carry the burden of our wives' mistakes. Did Christ carry the burden of our mistakes in a painful, hardship way? Yeah. Is it fair? I don't even know how to define fair, but some worldly sense it isn't. Okay. But that's just kind of the point. Love as Christ loved the church. Yeah, so I think there's some sense in the relationship that we should kind of have no other job. The single-minded purpose of Christ, and this is an exaggeration, of course, but I do think there's such an importance. If we're going to be the head of the wife, that ought to be a kind of a full-time job. And all of our thoughts about the relationship and the time we spend, the effort, ought to be what will be beneficial to her. I think that's what loving as Christ loved the church is about. And sacrifice? What do we do without? Does she have the best car? The most reliable car? The best clothing, right? the good side of the bed. I don't know whatever the things are like that. But what do we give up? We give up time with the guys, the game we like to watch, whatever, just for... So is there some sacrifice? What is the sacrifice that you make? Not in return for something either, just as part of the... Okay, help me now. You kind of getting the flavor of this? What would it mean in a practical way to sanctify and cleanse in the way that Christ did the church that way? We can put the next one together with it if you want to present glorious and so on. How would that... What would that look like in a practical relationship? But this is about husbands and wives, and yeah. Okay. All right, as if she was innocent, perhaps, yeah. Right.
Well, there's an idea of showing pride of having her as a wife.
Okay. I think that's the next one. Right. So it is not your job to make her look bad. It's the opposite. And if there is a mistake, it's to forgive it or not even acknowledge it, not even make it a part of the story. And if there's something she does well, that should be something that the whole world would know about and know that you know about it. I think I'm taking this directly from what Christ did for the church, by the way. I don't know what's going on in the principalities and powers world, but I know that somehow I'm being presented to them as innocent. I don't know how that works. I don't even understand it. I mean, but still, I don't deserve it. I promise you that. And so there's this forgiveness that came at cost, and there's this glory that's going to be poured on the church for some reason, not mine. Can you make that application to your wife? What would you ever criticize your wife in front of others? What would ever motivate someone to do that besides a selfish, worldly view of things? And if you think that's a way to change her somehow by, you know, somehow calling her out in front of people, even in joking, but especially in front of people, it doesn't matter, in front of anybody, kids especially, all of that. So now there's a negative side that we're talking about, but there's the positive side too. Find the things that can be praised and use that opportunity to do that. We're going to come back to forgiveness. I said that earlier. There's ever never created harm. And that could be both, I mean, obviously not physical harm in any way, but emotional harm or harm that comes from passive aggressive silent treatments or whatever it is. And then if there's some pain, it should be shared sympathetically, which is not our primary nature. Remember to be first of all sympathetic. But I think we can learn that and it can be easily a part of what we do. So there's this nourishment. Nourishment, I think, means filling up needs. And this is hard for us, but I think that there is a thing in women. It's part of that whole desire shall be for your husband. I didn't have anybody argue with me on that. I usually do. But I do think there's some need that women try to fill in various ways. Often in all the wrong ways, with all the wrong guys. I don't know what that's about. I think sometimes there's even like a cycle of abuse where this woman feels this great need or this insecurity, worthlessness or something. And holding on to this guy fills that need, whatever it is. And he hates it. He hates being clung to. And so he abuses her, really. It's almost his way of showing who's boss. And that doesn't drive her away. That's the strangest thing. There is the cycle, you may be aware of it, where the abused continues to come back to the abuser. There's some need or codependency that's built there. Instead of a vicious cycle, there's a virtuous cycle, I think, that goes the other way. Where if you see an emotional need, and it might be loneliness that's unjustified, but it's there. It's real as anything. It might be a feeling of worthlessness. It might be an insecurity about the future that in your mind is unjustified because you're confident and bold and you know what's going to happen. But it's there nonetheless. You detect those needs and you fill them. To me, this helps us understand 1 Peter 3. Dwell with your wives according to knowledge and understanding. I don't know if that's knowledge of the Bible, knowledge of women in general, knowledge of your wife in particular, but I suspect it's all three. That is, you're just informed about what the needs are. Okay, cares for. That means assists, pampers, pleases, and it's motivated by an affection. You can think of ways of doing that. Well, and then the one spirit thing, they're united in action and purpose. I think that communication is key, an outlet for sharing dreams and disappointments and feelings about things. And finally, love as yourself. And that is when I am involved in potentially creating pleasure and satisfaction, it's really primarily for her benefit. And that joy that I get is really just a reflection back of what I've created in her. I don't know if you see all that, but I believe that's not an abuse of the text in Ephesians 5. To think through in practical terms how what Christ did for the church can be projected into our marriages. And if you ever think to yourself it isn't fair, or it's too hard or whatever, you get trumped by the sacrifice of Christ. That's kind of the point. You can say this isn't fair, this is too hard, blah, blah, blah. It's not too hard. It doesn't even compare. Just forget that argument. Or I'm not getting anything in return. You heard that. I'm afraid one of the biggest damages that's done by often by worldly counselors is they move the relationship between men and women into the space of contracting. You know what contract? Y'all, anybody here in contracts? You know what contracts are? It's an agreement where I say I'm going to do this for you, and you're going to do this for me. And what happens if you don't do this for me? I don't have to do this for you. You broke the contract on that other side. So counseling has this flavor that says, "Look, if you agree not to get angry, would you agree to do this other thing, to be more courteous or whatever?" You know what I mean? And what's the problem with that model? But they both should be doing that, no doubt about it. But what's the problem with that model? Okay, it might not be. First of all, I'm doing it because of what I get back, right? Not because of what's right. That's probably the heart of what's wrong with it. Yeah.
I think there's often some responsibility or job that needs to be done where no one's been assigned, and then they argue who's going to take up the slack.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, that's not in the contract. That's out of scope. Pardon? Absolutely. It's just and I have an excuse now, too, because, hey, you didn't do what you said you were going to do. In fact, I'm going to wait and see if you do what you do before I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And so, you know, it's what's the reason you do the things is not it's in the contract or what you're going to benefit from that. It's because it's right to do. If you want to look at a contract, look at the contract Christ has made with us. And he already did his part. And it's overwhelmingly correct. So we don't have any excuse. We just have to do that. We have to go forward. Yeah.
Notice marriage is like 100% and 100%. In other words, so like if there is some shortfall, the other person takes it up.
Right.
And I feel like you work as a group of team that way. You know, we can help one another. I might get real busy at work and she does some things I normally do, or vice versa, or she may be sick and I can prepare a meal or something.
Right. So I might talk some more about. Right, that's right. It may be somewhat mechanical, right? And really, in the end, there must be some type of I'm going to outdo you in my side of this situation. I don't know if this is the best time to talk about this, but I think it's helpful. A little bit about counseling folks that have messed up, where they've had had an affair or something. We've talked about difference in men. Do you understand that when people are unfaithful in a sexual sense, that men and women are quite different in that? And I'm just telling you this because I think it helps understand what some of the needs might be, how this works. This probably won't surprise you. When men are, you know, have an affair, it's rarely, maybe I should ask you because you probably know this intuitively. Is it because the man has found a soulmate? And they decide, I'm changing partners because this is the person I really need to be with the rest of my life? Or are they just sexually attracted to somebody who's available and that's what happens? Which of those two do you think is more likely the case? Number two is what I'm hearing. Yeah, that's true. On the other hand, when a woman eventually has an affair, which I think is less frequent, it's part of their nature. They're superior to us, by the way. Is it because they're just in the moment are overwhelmed by sexual desire, or is it because they maybe think for the moment they have found a new soulmate and that it leads to that? Which of those two? It's really more the second, I'm telling you that. And it doesn't happen quite as often. Maybe it happens more now. Maybe the world is getting to where women believe they just should follow their fleshly desires too. But I think in general... So one of the difficulties for reconciling a couple once that's happened, and it can be done, and I will say it should be done. I think it should be treated as not optional. You need to work it out. And I'll talk more. I'll start shouting about that after at a break if you want to talk about it. But here's one of the difficulties, and that is when a man's been unfaithful, the woman sees what he's done as if she had done it. And what she thinks has happened is what? So what does she think has happened? She's probably not thinking, oh, he was overcome by sexual desires and he just messed up. She's projecting what she would have done, how that would have happened to her. So what's she thinking, the guy's? What's happened? He's found another soulmate. That's what she sees. Even it might be a prostitute, but that, you know what I mean? But still, in her mind, you'd never do that unless you had some... So she's thinking to herself, I've been replaced as a person, you know, as a companion. You know, and so there's this deeper sense of betrayal I think women feel than men. I'm just telling you this somewhat from experience. And I'm trying to turn that around to say for this, for some of these things right here, she needs to feel that you are loyal to her soul. You know, you're not just attracted to her body. You understand that? And that's just one of the things that has to be addressed. It's just a deeper thing than that. And so for now, I understand that very often men will be first attracted to some woman who fills their ego. Maybe it's the attractive secretary and they're kind of amazed that some younger woman would be interested in someone their age. You know, that kind of happens, appeal to ego. But it's not because they found a new, necessarily lifelong partner and they're thinking life will be better with this person than the other. And it makes the betrayal even deeper. Those are things to think about. Well, let's go back to the ideal again. So remember this picture. This is the fall. And what happened after the fall is that there's pain in childbirth. The woman will have a desire to her husband, whatever that means. And I think it's some kind of emotional dependency that works out in a non-productive way. And the man tends to rule over her. Probably not the best situation. What is it? And somebody already did this part of the lesson earlier today. What's the command now we just saw in Ephesians 5? For the man, what's his responsibility? Love the husband. The wife isn't told to love her husband. On the other hand, the husband isn't told to rule over his wife. What's the wife told to do? Submit. So if I draw this picture in Christ, and the man has this tendency to want to be in control, to dominate the woman as if she were part of the creation, which he's told to control. It's part of his ego to have a woman that's in control and respects him and all that. And what if she just voluntarily submits? What does that happen to that curse in the fall? And whatever he gained in terms of ego or satisfaction or accomplishment or victory in controlling his wife, he gets that without that effort. At the same time, whatever it is that draws the woman to the man or tries to have her draw him into her to fill some need, once again, a curse, one of the curses, not a good thing, part of the fallen world, what is this thing? This love. And so she has no need to do whatever that is. And I don't know for sure what all it involves, but I think the point about love then covers that over. And so their needs are fulfilled. Their natural tendency is kind of overcome by the other one satisfying that need that they have. So the consequences of the fall are mitigated by Christ-like character. I don't know for sure. I think the book has some more boxes and stuff. Maybe that pain in childbirth is also somewhat overcome by honor your father and mother or some other verses like that. I don't know. This is weaker. This is a side point. And maybe when the parents chasten, love, nurture, manage, these are all Bible terms for the children, that's something that maybe makes that pain in childbirth worthwhile or somehow overcomes that. Side point, how would you cover over that last one that's not kind of fixed in God's plan? And by the way, you realize none of these are completely fixed, right? We're still in a fallen world. We're not perfect. I wonder how this thorns and thistles and sweat of your face is fixed. I don't know. Maybe I'll leave that as an exercise for the reader. Maybe it's not fixed. Okay. And the whole creation groans in travail, right? Awaiting the redemption. So maybe that's it. I don't know. So I have to ask you. Yeah. Yep. Question.
Maybe in the ingenuity that God gave man to build basic machines.
Could be. Maybe there's. Yeah, I actually have read that. I can't remember. One of the theologians in the Middle Ages believed that it was kind of as the scientific revolution. He thought that was the solution to the fallen world, would be man's innovation in technology. I don't know. So we had just selected a new director about a year ago at work, and in the academic environment, a selection process is very open. And there are all these, they have to give a briefing to the entire staff, which is hundreds of people, their vision, you know. And so you have these group interviews with various different organizations within the institute where they're going to be the director. You guys have, any of you been through that kind of thing before? Maybe not quite as public as I'm describing. Or you yourself have been on an interview maybe before, right? You've been called in an interview. One of the questions that gets asked a lot is, you know, what do you think are the strengths of this organization, right? And what are the weaknesses? And what's your vision for how we're going to, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to leverage our strengths? And where do you see us going? And what are we going to emphasize in the future? And what are we going to correct so we don't? Are those fair questions for an interview to be, say, a director of a large academic institute? Are they fair? Yeah. Perhaps you know where I'm going with this. Are you ready for your interview to be head of your family? What is your vision for this family? Where will it be in 5 years? What are the strengths of this family? You're in the interview. What would you say? What are our weaknesses? What are the things we can accomplish based on our core competencies, you know, or our discriminators, to use business terms, right? I do think if you're going to be the head, there ought to be some realistic assessment of what's wrong right this minute and where shall we go in 5 to 10 years. Is that fair as a husband? Could you write that down on a piece of paper that says, this is my vision for the family. In 5 to 10 years, this is what I want to happen. Now, remember, we saw in the pyramid, I don't know if I made as big a deal about this, how did that decision that Paul made about going to Rome work out? Did it work out the way he thought it was going to? Remember the plan? Get ready, go to Rome, go on to Spain. No, he got arrested, he got thrown in jail in Rome. Now, maybe during that, if there was a middle release before the second, maybe he got to Spain. Nobody knows. I don't mean nobody alive today knows. We don't know. He got to Rome in some one way or another. But the whole Spain thing, we don't know. I'm not saying you have to make it happen. And we shouldn't measure ourselves by whether everything we said happened was going to happen. But it seemed like we ought to be accountable to say, where will my family be? You think James 4 is a prohibition about making plans? In the context, there's a kind of a surrounding context about. In fact, he even says, you know what? You can pray for the wrong reasons, right? You ask, but you ask amiss. Why? By the way, pyramid. Think pyramids. So you just want stuff that you can, you know, enjoy. That's what. And he goes on to talk about the rich and their abuse. So it may just be that it's the financial side, or I think it's the assumption that we really do control the future, and we have that. But I don't think it. I'm trying to give you a picture of Paul who made these plans to go on to Spain. I think there's several. It's a look ahead. He was doing some strategic thinking about why am I going there? What am I going to do? I think that's not a bad pattern. And it may be that none of this works out because somebody gets real sick and all that goes out the window. Still, it gives us direction for making some decisions in the near term. And for sure, the vision ought not to be, it seems to me, that we will have saved, you know, $500,000 and I'll retire. Maybe not around carnal things. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's what James is about. But it could be that. So I'm asking you, if you're the head of your house, stop thinking in terms of being the primary decision maker. To be honest, I'm struggling to find that in the text. I see a lot of other things that seem like get in front of the line as opposed to, well, it comes down when it's a tie, I break the tie. Or, you know, I make all the important decisions. It reminds me of the story. Guy got married and they said, how's it going? He says, great, we got a great arrangement. I make all the big decisions and she makes all the little decisions. That's the way it works. And I said, well, so does that work pretty good? And he said, well, yeah. I mean, we haven't come to any big decisions yet, but yeah. We skipped over the module in that's on just in the appendix, but why did James and John want to be on the right and the left hand of Jesus? Why did they want to be there? I mean, this is what I always ask. How many more hands did Jesus have, right? So it was a limited opportunity to be at the top of the authority chain, right? And what the benefit of that was, maybe they could call some shots. And maybe, of course, Jesus' discussion of the Gentiles is they lorded over those over them. For whose benefit? For those over that they're over or for their own benefit? I worry that don't glom in too much on who's the key decision maker. I think that might be the wrong way to think about headship. Yep. So y'all correct me. Sometimes I get these notional, like extreme, bizarre ideas, and I say, oh yeah, that's right. There is a verse that says exactly that. You know. So, but we get too, I think, zeroed in on who's in charge and who's going to make the decision. We forget all that. This is what this chart is. Sorry, this chart right there is about. This is what it says about Christ and the church. And it sure enough says the church submits to Christ. But when it looks at Christ, it's not highlighting the fact that he gives all the orders. It's highlighting all the work and sacrifice that he did. I think that's the picture of headship that the Bible paints. I don't know. Once again, I'm probably out on the extreme again. But anyway, it seems to me that first you say, where are we now? Where do we want to go? And then what near-term initiatives? And that's kind of a tactical thinking. And I think it starts tomorrow or Tuesday or this week to say, you know what, we've got to start a regular Bible study at home. Or, you know what, the kids are not getting their lessons for Bible class done as well as they really should. We know that. We don't really spend any time on it. Let's set an alarm clock or do something to, you know, help us. So you start to take these steps, but they're in the context of this bigger plan. In 5 to 10 years, here's what we'd like to accomplish. That's what I'm trying to say with this chart. You want to be the head and you want to make some decisions? Start with this. Interview for what is the strategic plan for your family and what tactical actions and changes are you making? That's a lot more important than I get to decide where we go out to eat or whatever the thing is. Right. Okay, I have to talk about... Yes?
I'm thinking that it's better to look at ways to encourage each member of the family to grow rather than just giving specific...
Sure. Yep, right. Yeah, there's a tailored plan for each kid, for each, yeah. Well, in fact, we'll have a little bit more about that later. I want to talk about forgiveness as almost, it relates to what Jesus did, and we'll probably be referring to that. But I want to think about the forgiveness process. You know how forgiveness works. I'll just tell you the story of how it works. First of all, someone does something wrong, and we will call that person the sinner. And they do something wrong that hurts someone else. And that's going to be called the victim. Okay? Right? And so that forgiveness, I mean that sin, that offense, I'm trying to think of that word, that offense, it goes on a list. And the victim holds that list because after all, who is going to have to do the forgiving? It's the victim, right? And eventually, we hope, this sinner comes to his or her senses and they say, I have done wrong. And they say, I repent of that. And so I'm going to come to this person and I'm going to ask the victim for forgiveness. Y'all agree with the story so far? Is this the way it works? I mean, forgiveness then, if they're good people, is granted by the victim. In fact, we even know how many times in a day you have to do that. 7 times, according to Luke. And how many times in a lifetime? What's the lifetime limit on this? It's like insurance, right? All right. 70 times 7. That's all. Just that much, and then you're done. But anyway, if you grant forgiveness, but that's a lot. That, you ought to be. And then the relationship is restored. Do you see any problem with this model? I mean, I'm thinking about husband and wife, but we're in that lesson right now. Your wife does something wrong, goes on the list. Wait, maybe I encourage her to repent of that because I don't want her to be lost. And she finally comes to her senses and comes to me and asks for forgiveness. And so I cross it off the list and she's forgiven. And after all, you cannot forgive someone who has not asked for forgiveness. Hey, can you? Isn't that in the Bible somewhere? Oh, they have to repent, yeah. In fact, if they sin really bad, they have to repent with a capital R, and that means they have to come forward during a service. And if it's a really bad sin, they have to do that. Do you have any problem with this story? Of course, I've been a little facetious as I've told it. But...
Love takes no account of wrongs.
Pardon?
Love takes no account.
No account. Where did you get that verse from? He says love does not keep account of evil. Or something. Yeah, and if I remember right, that's like an actual accounting term. It has to do with putting someone on a ledger sheet or something like that. Do you hear what he said? Love just, so the first thing that bothers me is that little checkbox, because I put it on there on this purpose. But really, I think that one problem is it really right to have a list on other people? I think that's what 1 Corinthians 13 is forbidding us from doing, right? Is I'm not keeping track of things. That's one thing. Second, sometimes it's not a sin, right? I mean, they actually stumbled and they stepped on my foot and it broke my toe and my toe really hurts. And they've offended me in some sense. They've done a wrong and it's caused harm and all that. And they probably did ask for forgiveness or apologize or something. But was that really a sin? Yes, I'm sorry you've been... Doesn't it? I hope you could hear what he's saying. You know, how do you have bitterness in your heart against someone? You have to kind of keep a list to keep that thing. I'm thinking about yeast and dough. You know, it has to keep getting fermented, you know, with something. And I think these lists of all the wrongs that somebody's done are part of the things that do that. And of course, what if it's not clear whether it's a sin or not? Right? And what if it wasn't intentional? Or what if I don't know whether it was intentional or not? Do you see that there's going to be some ambiguity here? So one thing about this whole picture is it's a little clearer than the world actually is from our point of view. So here's a passage I would like to think about. Colossians here. As elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies. I think that's an anatomical thing, like bowels of compassion. Kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with. And I don't know how to pronounce the nekomai, bearing with or forbearing. Some translations call it forbearing, which is the word we'll use some, with another, and forgiving. Two different things, but they're right there together. What does one mean? What is the difference between forbearing and forgiving? What would you think right off? Forbearing and forgiving. What would be the difference? What's that?
You're just putting up with it if you're forbearing.
Yeah, right. It means that, you know, you maybe haven't forgiven, but you're dealing with it, yeah. I mean, one thought would be forbearing is just things that are annoying, but they're not sinful. That'd be one idea. Inconvenient, troubling, you know, annoying, you know, but not sin. But forgiving is what you do if somebody really sins and they hurt you in some way. Right.
It's yep. Not a sin. I think it's just as overlooking.
Yeah, so just an inconvenience or annoyance, right. Here's the word itself. It literally means to hold up against oneself, to put up with, bear, endure. Vine says the quality of self-restraint in the face of provocation, which does not hastily retaliate or promptly punish. The opposite of anger is associated with mercy. Interesting, the Vine's picture is saying that this person may deserve punishment, right? and may deserve this angry reaction, but it's withheld, restrained, and that's forbearance. So let's, now we got it. Which is forbearance and which is forgiveness? This is not going to be hard. So this is the case. Your spouse is too short, and that inconveniences you. Is that something you forgive them for, or you forbear? See, I told you it's going to be easy. They lie to you over a minor matter. Is that something you forbear or forgive? Oh, now we're getting both. Can't do that. No. How many think it's forbear? How many think it's forgive? These are okay. Lies to you over a major matter. You forgive. Oh, that's definitely over and forgive. That's on the list, by the way. We can cross that. Has a habit that annoys you. For example, the wife might say, "He is cold and he won't communicate with me." Is that right? Or she annoys me with questions and criticisms all the time. Is that forbearance or forgiveness? It's a habit. How about if they continue that annoying habit after you ask them to stop? Forbear or forgive? But I ask her to stop, you know, whatever it is. Blowing her nose without covering it up. I don't know. But she keeps doing it. She knows I don't like it. Accidentally loses a large amount of money. Intentionally wastes a large amount of money. Right? Now, is it possible that the idea of whether money was wasted or not is a little bit subject to interpretation? And then disagrees with you that he or she has done something wrong, right? In wasting that money or not wasting that money. Continues in an immoral habit. Accuses you falsely before others. Now, these seem more serious in some ways, right? So I'm kind of making a point here. Can you always tell whether it's forbearance or forgiveness? That's one thing. What you have to know to do that is to know someone to some extent, right? I think that's part of it. And there may be some other factors that are really more important. And really, maybe it doesn't matter. If you forbear someone, what do you do? How do you act toward them? If you forbear, truly, you know, forbear what they're doing. What do you do? How do you act toward them? Like you've forgiven them. Interesting. That's where I was trying to get to. We got there quicker. I was going to say, and what do you act towards someone if you forgive them? What do? You do this thing we saw in Vines. You don't punish them even though they deserve it, right? And if you forbear, you don't punish them even though they may deserve it. And I don't know whether it's intentional or not intentional. I don't know if it's an act of malice or if it's just an act of carelessness. I don't know. But actually, I'm going to act the same way. And there's kind of an interesting extreme here. Where if you love someone, even though they're harming you, what if they're down here in the immoral habit and creating a, you know, they're actually becoming your enemy. Making my life miserable, like those last two might actually do, right? What does Jesus say we're supposed to do toward our enemies? So I mean, actually, I can push the thing all the way to the place where there's great harm being caused, and I'm still acting the same way. And whether I've forgiven them in some technical sense or not, I'm not sure that really matters. If that makes sense. The idea that we somehow carry around the right to punish people by some means or another because they haven't quite asked for forgiveness or haven't lived up to a standard, I think we're missing the point. Here's some other things to think about. Did you know that God forbears? That word is used, the very same word is used about God. God sent forth Jesus as a propitiation by His blood through faith to demonstrate His righteousness because in His forbearance, forbearance, God passed over the sins that were previously committed. Were these sins or accidents? Right? Was this intentional or unintentional? And yet God forbear. Why did He forbear those sins all through the ages? People deserve to be punished. Why would He let that go and treat people with love and let the rain and the sun shine upon the just and the unjust and all of that? What would He do that for? Be diligent to be found by him in spot, blameless. And consider that the long suffering, which is not the same word, but it's often used in connection with forbearance, of our Lord is for what purpose? Do y'all know what that passage is about? About the Lord isn't slack concerning his promises. Remember all that? But he is kind of holding back this judgment. For what reason? Not willing that any should perish. But the purpose for that is for salvation, right? Romans 2. Do you think this, that you who judge those practicing such things and doing the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or you do you despise the riches of his goodness, that is the word, forbearance and longsuffering, see they're paired together, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to what? Now that's an interesting approach, an interesting thought, that not treating someone as if they had sinned would lead to their repentance and their salvation. Is that a possible thing that God does for us? That he's holding back judgment in what hope? That he's holding back the punishment we deserve and so on. Do y'all see what I'm getting? Now, I know you're getting uncomfortable with this idea. Wait a minute. I can't just take any wrong, watch my wife do all these terrible, nasty, immoral things and not say anything about it. Not worry about forgiving because that's too technical. So, are there reasons that a sin might need to be confronted? And the Bible talks about if a brother sinned against you, you need to confront them, right? That's Matthew 18 as an example. We could wear ourselves out doing that for everything that, you know, wrong has ever happened, I think. I wonder if there's a case where you might need to... Well, let's just look at other commands of forbearance as just an informative thing. We that are strong ought to bear with the scruples of the weak. That's in the context of eating meats, right? Romans 14. Which means I'm going to suffer along with... By the way, this reminds us of last night. With whom? With the weak. That's kind of who we're concerned about in all of this. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Do you know what comes before that passage, Galatians 6:1? Where it's talking about bearing one another's burdens. Verse before... I think it's something like, if a man has overtaken any trespass, you that are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. It has to do with helping people who are trapped by sin in some way. Give no offense in anything. By purity, knowledge, long-suffering. There's a case where I don't want to make someone else stumble, so I will suffer with their weakness. Walk worthy of the calling which you were called. Gentle, long-suffering, to what? For keeping the unity of the Spirit. Do any of these apply in marriage, perhaps? Where there's a weakness that needs to be overcome? Where I don't want to offend someone? Where I want to maintain the unity of the relationship? I think these apply. Okay. I do think there is a place to confront the wrong, but it's probably more of a special case than the other. I think in James it says that one of the reasons for going to a sinner and turning them is it saves them from death. I think if a person's involved in continuing immorality and it's clear it's jeopardizing their soul, it's destroying and eroding their faith in God, that's got to be addressed as an act of love for their benefit. That's got to be addressed. And that's what Matthew 18 seems to be saying. You're gaining your brother. Try to go and bring them back. 1 Corinthians 15, the same thing. For the destruction of the flesh that the soul may be saved. Something that jeopardizes their soul. Matthew 18:2, I think, too, that any kind of a difference or sin or hard feelings that is destroying the unity of the relationship probably needs to be confronted. But I would just say to you that I think the concept of forgiving and forbearing means that we ignore a lot of things that might not even be the best moral character or the best spiritual decision-making. And the reason is we want to preserve the unity. Why did God do it with us? Because he was hoping to bring us to repentance. And God's approach during that was not just to hold back judgment, but to pour mercy on us. Rain on the just and the unjust. And he's saying, are you despising that grace that God's given you and postponing that? And it seems to me in our relationships, forbearance is a key thing. Okay. Now, I say all that to say, here are some symptoms to watch for. Are you keeping account, remembering, reviewing things that are wrong? And looking for things to add to that list. Look in your heart. If you in your idle time are thinking about your relationship and thinking about all the things you wish were different or that hurt you and they're still there, you're doing, whoever said that before, right? Oh, yeah. The keeping a list makes me bitter in my heart. If you see that list somewhere in your memory, you're struggling with this. Waiting for the other person to change first as a precondition of my kindness. That's the contractual approach. You know what? You haven't asked for forgiveness on this, and I'm carrying this around until you do. And you're going to get the silent treatment, or you're going to get this other disadvantage with regard to me because of what you've done. And I'm waiting for you to fix that on your side. Maybe I justify my own sin, which could include gossiping to someone else about how terrible this person is, sharing that secret disadvantage that I have because of them, or this cruelty, or this stupidity, or this other stuff that I have to put up with someone else. But I'm justified by that because of what they've done to me and the inconvenience I've suffered. This one worries me a lot, and that is, you judge the entire character of a person by a specific sinful action and something they said. 17 years ago, this is what they did. And I know from that they're not genuine. You know, everything good they do, all the things that they've said, all the positive qualities, you know they're just a veneer and hypocrisy because of what they did 17 years ago. That's a worrisome thing. Or what they said. And I'll tell you, turn that around. Would you like to be judged by that? By the one thing you messed up on, and that's an indicator of the whole totality of your character, no matter how hard you try to do other good things? I hope that's not characterizing what we do. Grumbling to others about the burden I bear, maybe avoiding the situation or the discussion or the person because of what they've done to me, and feeling superior because I carry this shortcoming, this sin, this memory around because of the wrongs done to me, not remembering the golden rule in applying all these things. I wanted to say that a little bit as a practical thing with regard to relationship. Do not formalize forgiveness, please. Let's just push forbearance to its limits if we can, right? And I think the limits are when a person's soul's in jeopardy, and then it's a loving act, and when the relationship is in jeopardy, the unity of the relationship is in jeopardy, you got to reconcile, and you need to call things out into the open and deal with them and work through that.
By the way, as a leader,
who has responsibility to initiate those reconciliations and to acknowledge the problems? So that's on our side, looking at wrongs done to me. I think that whole situation flips over when the person may feel that I have done something wrong to them. You know, that's the symmetric other side of this. Is our responsibility there to ignore that the same way? Or is it the opposite? In fact, Jesus says something about that. If I think some brother has something against me, what am I supposed to do? Wait till after the worship is over and then talk to them about it. What does he actually say in the text? Leave it there. I know you're right in the middle of the sacrament. Leave it there. Go take care of it right now. Right now. And right. So I think the urgency of being the initiator of fixing things when it might be that we're on the offending side, right? We're the one who's... That's reversed. I think now there's this great urgency for us to be proactive about that along the other side. Whereas the other side, forbearance is not anything but suffering along with whatever the circumstance is. Okay? Yes?
To the point that you're making, this reminds me of a situation that David, when he had to leave his throne because his son Absalom was taken over, and this gentleman was forever lost. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name correctly. I think it was Shimei or Shimei.
Yeah, right. The guy on the hill?
Pardon?
Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right.
I think it was one of the sons of Uzziah just wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
And he was so angry.
Yeah.
Who is he to curse you, the king? And David just let it go. Perhaps this is what the Lord wanted.
That's such a rich story. What's the background behind why David was so reluctant to go punish the guy? Well, he was in a situation where Absalom had kind of thrown him out, and there'd been a lot of bloodshed, you know, in his, like, with what Absalom had done and so on. But why did David not really feel like he could go and punish that guy? Was there more involved in that too? Yep. Yeah, I think that David had kind of lost his moral authority. In some ways, David was saying to himself, you know what, I kind of deserve this. Maybe that's part of the reason he's saying, yeah, he's kind of right. We're not going to take revenge on him. So let's make an application. Is it possible that we kind of ought to look at ourselves and say, I kind of deserve this. I don't get it all right. I'm as big a burden as anybody else around here. You know what I mean? Not to excuse it, not to not fix it, but I'm just saying, I think we should feel that same kind of humility. And it's the golden rule part of down here. I really hope people overlook a whole bunch of sloppiness and crudity and smelliness and everything else that characterizes men. Don't we ask for that? Aren't we really asking for that? And I think we can be accommodating in the other way too. Maybe that's what was behind, part of what's behind that story. Forbearance leading to forgiveness. Right, good point. I think that is the point. I think if we return good for evil, that wonderful passage in Romans, to me, it's just such a great picture. Even in the case where you're severely wronged by someone else, he says, do not be overcome with evil. I think that's what the list keeping will do to you, to your point. You're just being overcome with evil. That doesn't mean that evil's getting hold of you. You're doing sinful things. It's just, if you look at that text, it says, don't, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And he says, give space for vengeance, or something like that, which is a puzzling phrase. But I think here's the picture of that. If this person has done something really bad to me, right, my inclination, especially as a macho man, is to go and get respect and pay them back and 77-fold Lamech's language, right? And I'm ready to take that vengeance. I think the language is implying, because he goes on to say, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. He says, give space to vengeance. He's not saying, make some time out in your life to go make sure you get even with them. That's not the point. It's the opposite of that. He's saying, look, guys, let's clear out some space here, right? And that space is going to be cleared out for who to take vengeance? For God. And he may or he may not. But you know, if you've been wronged, deeply wronged by someone, and you treat them with love, and something bad happens to them, did you do that? It's pretty obvious you didn't do it. I think that making space is actually overcoming good with evil. Did I say that backwards? Overcoming evil with good, right? So I'll just be specific, because this is where it always comes up in my mind. You're counseling someone. They have been deeply betrayed in a relationship, maybe. Maybe immorality is involved. And you try to say to them, look, I know you feel like this person has not suffered enough for what they have done to you. I know you feel that way. And I know you feel like they're not sorry enough, and they don't look sad enough, and they haven't been punished by public disgrace enough. I know that's true. And you know what? You're probably right in every one of those things. It's probably true. But if you take it on yourself to shut them off and give them the cold shoulder and make sure they get exposed publicly and get what they deserve, you are not leaving space for God to take care of this himself, right? And it could be that in their life, if they don't repent fully and they continue in that evil, God's going to bring something terrible on them. It could be that. But you don't need to be around when that happens. You need to have put a space of love around them. So when it's all done, you can say, you know what? Looking back 10 years, I did everything I could with that relationship, right? And you know what? You will probably be the doormat. Get over that. You know the trump card I'm going to throw on that, right? Same one. Yes, Scott. Yeah. Yeah. So you don't either? Oh, really? I didn't know that part of the story. Yeah. So is that leaving space for revengeance? I don't know. Somebody else doing it. But y'all see what I'm saying here. I think really a key thing, an important thing in forgiveness, and even if there's never to be a change, never to be repentance, even about some terrible thing, I want to be able to face God and say, I didn't take the vengeance. I didn't take it on myself to be the one to punish them. I left space. I think the way you leave that space is you return good for evil, right? You love your enemies, as Jesus said. If this person has become your enemy because they betray you and they trick you and they say they're going to change and they don't, I gave them all the space I could. I treated them as trustworthy, even though they weren't, right? I loved them selflessly, even though that was not in return. Do you think that's what that passage means in Romans 12? I think that's forbearance. To me, it is. I know. And my intent is for their good, not mine. Never heard of that story before. Okay, I think we're... Yep, go ahead. After God's own heart. Sure. Yeah. Perfect example of giving space for vengeance. Did God take care of Saul? Yeah. And David could look back. In fact, that was one of Abigail's arguments. I love that, right? And the Nabal thing was, look, you know what? When you come to power, you won't have this on your record. No one will ever say that you kind of captured the throne or something like that. You did everything honorably and God took care of it. That's what I call giving space, Romans 12, or however yours reads. And I think there's a direct application in our personal relationships with people, even when we're deeply betrayed. But certainly when they're just too short, right? Or clumsy, or not good with money, or make a mistake, or wreck the car, or whatever the thing is that might be annoying to us, and we might think we need to carry that around for a while before we forgive them on our list. Right. Right. So here's what I want to say is, I think there's a spectrum that goes all the way from too short and I'm always having to get stuff out of the cabinet for them, through they're just careless, you know, or clumsy, or they don't think ahead, right? Or they kind of not very polite or courteous, right? Or they're a little bit selfish from time to time, to they've really done a couple of pretty bad immoral things, to they have absolutely betrayed me over here. Now, the problem with that, and you see that spectrum, right? This is clearly terrible sin, soul in jeopardy. That one way over there, not at all. Where are you going to draw the line and say, well, that's the sin we care about? You see what I'm saying? Would you draw it way down here, or would you draw it way down there? And the answer is, I don't think you need to draw a line. Treat everybody with love. Hope for their repentance. Give them kindness. If you're way down there, give space for wrath. Love your enemies. That's what that's about. If you're way down there, forbearing and forgiving. You'd ignore it and you don't make it a test of the relationship. Does that make sense? I don't know if I made... Maybe that was a clearer way to say it. That's what I'm trying to say. Let's don't make a line and say that you got to forgive them for this and you don't... That's not it. Right. There's not any difference in the way we treat people anyway. That's kind of the idea. Okay. Let's take a break. All right, we're down to the shorter strokes here. I'm gonna want to go ahead and talk about romance a little bit because we said we were going to earlier. I think that's the next thing coming up. Just a quick background about romance. Now, romance is really not a biblical topic, right? I mean, the Bible, you just get married and that's it. Is that right? Is there any reference to romance in the Bible? He says Song of Solomon is about that. I think there, through the ages, there have been Bible scholars that it bothered them so much that they said, no, that's just an allegory. It has to be just an, you know what I mean? But yes, right, and we'll talk about Song of Solomon. I'm not sure we have a bunch of time, but I do want to just look at the scene after the wedding scene and look at that. So here's what some things, I don't know what to make of all of this. I just, at one point I said, I'm going to figure out what the Bible says about relates to marriage, and I'm going to go through and figure out in the Bible, what does it say? And here's some things. Sometimes romance was created in arranged marriages, even when the people were strangers. And I'm quoting the Isaac and Rebekah. So remember that story? Now, the poor guy just lost his mother, so maybe he was just, you know, it was an opportune time for this beautiful girl to show up on a... Okay, that's one. Sometimes the romance romance beforehand led to the arranging of marriages. Right? Remember Samson? Don't know if I would call that full-fledged romance, but let's just say it was some kind of desire. And he says, I want this woman to marry. Right? Sometimes, though there was romance at the beginning, I guess Michael, if that's the way you say her name. Remember Michael? She loved David at first, anyway, until he kind of embarrassed her or something. I don't know what the deal about dancing in front of the ark, but in the early days, I mean, what young girl probably didn't love David, right? Who had slain his 10,000s. He was a rock star, right? And who would not love him? So she did, and she saved him. Remember that? She hid or put a mannequin or something in the bed. And so, yeah, she loved him. Did that guarantee the success of their relationship? Of course, her being given away for a while didn't probably help, but anyway. Sometimes romance existed in polygamous marriages. And guess what? Big surprise, it created problems. I don't know what else to say about that. Sometimes it existed outside relationships and marriage. That never happens, right? And it led to immorality. So I don't know what to make of that. I guess what I make of it is that I'm not sure that romance and marriage are quite as coupled as we think they are. Okay, so let's think about that just a little bit. And I can express it in a couple of different ways. Just because you're romantically attracted to someone probably doesn't mean you should marry them. That's one thing, right? And just because you're not romantically connected with someone doesn't mean you should divorce them. But I don't know what more we can conclude from that unless we look a little bit deeper at the phenomena itself. Okay. There is some teaching about romantic love, and I would just summarize some lessons from the Song of Solomon. We'll get to Proverbs in just a minute when we dealing with children. But I just want to talk about Proverbs and Song of Solomon in the collection of wisdom literature, as we call it. Ecclesiastes and Job, you might put in that category. To whom was the Proverbs written? And it starts out by kind of saying who's supposed to learn from it, gain wisdom. Who's it? What does it say? Yeah, it's kind of the simple, but it's kind of my son. That phrase, written to my son. The implication is that a Proverbs probably maybe is a father's wisdom being passed down to a son. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. And of course, we all know, except the last chapter of Proverbs, which is chapter 31, which was clearly written for women, right? And the way I know that is because that's what all the women's classes study. Right? Isn't that right? You know, what's Proverbs 31 about? The worthy woman. And the reason I know it says the worthy woman, who can be? Is that what it says? Who can find? As if it might have been written for a man who would be thinking about whom he might want to choose as a mate. However, on the other hand, if I open the book of Song of Solomon and look through it, I don't know how many of you have studied it before, but whose point of view is the Song of Solomon mostly written from? And by that, I mean both characters speak, but there's one of the two characters. I'm taking the two-character view, by the way, and I don't want to get into all the reasons, but two-character view. Whose thoughts are we listening to mostly throughout the book?
The young woman.
Yeah, it's the woman's thoughts and her anxieties and her bad dreams, right? And it's interesting in the wedding scene, and I'm thinking about movies like The Sound of Music. That's how old I am. But when you know that in that you cut to the scene and they're getting married. And da 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 da, and where's the camera pan right then? Who's it panned to? Well, who's it on? It's on the bride. There she is. She's coming in the back. White dress. In this book, the wedding scene, who's the camera on? Who is it? It's Solomon coming up and his military men and all that. It's almost as if it's the view of the woman watching this groom coming to be with her. But I think zooming out on the book, there are some lessons to learn. Romantic love exists for marriage, not the other way around. That's just another way of drawing that pyramid the way we drew it before. That's what I'm saying. And we'll talk about that. It contributes to the primary function of marriage, which is companionship. It can and should be developed between married couples, but marriage neither validated or invalidated by the presence or absence of romance. I'm not sure I find that in the Song of Solomon, but I still think that's the case. Here's an interesting thought. I think I have to credit C.S. Lewis for this. Romantic love seeks to possess the individual and be possessed by that individual. In fact, you'll find this repeated phrase. In fact, it has an interest. It evolves. It's three times. My beloved is mine and I am his. That's the first time. And who comes first is I own this guy. I own him. Next time you find it, he says, I am my beloved's and he is mine. That's an interesting reversal. Turns that around. I belong to him. And the last time it says, I am my beloved's. That's it. So you see this kind of growing ownership of two individuals. Now this is what C.S. Lewis says. You hear the guys and they're drinking and they're saying, let's go get some women. And what his point is, the last thing they actually want is a woman. They want sex, but they don't want a woman, right? The last thing they want is a commitment, some responsibility, some accountability, right? They want the experience. They're not looking to own and possess and be possessed by the individual. This is a soulmate relationship as it's described here. And while there is discussion of physical pleasures, it should grow to be less self-centered until it finally becomes ownership by another. And that repeated phrase, I think, throughout the book kind of illustrates. I'd also add that sexual attraction in some ways is the same as any other physical appetite. God gave it to us. It can be fulfilled without guilt or shame. It appears and disappears, unfortunately, at opportune and inopportune times, but it has to be controlled nonetheless, right? Like other desires, it can be ruled and it can be overruled by moral and intellectual aspects of man. I'm going to say more about that in the marriage relationship. And here's kind of a key thing. Romance can be improved and enhanced by effort in compliance with God's word. I wish we could spend more time looking at that, but in the process, I think it's the second bad dream she has. The chorus, which I picture as some of the girls come in and they're in this play, they're telling her thing, and they just start asking her questions. Who are you? How did you get to be where you are? And she starts remembering all the great things in there. So it's almost by intellectual effort and memory, she is able to rethink, oh, that's right. This man does mean a lot to me. And he has changed my life. And I do miss him a lot, despite the fact he's being a jerk right now. That, you know, they bring her back to that by looking at the past, by intellectual effort. It's not a God. It doesn't overrule God's laws. So let's look at Song of Solomon, if you can find it in your Bible. I think it would be right after Ecclesiastes. If you have a Bible that's marked up, you know, from, I bet your Song of Solomon is not marked up very much. I might be wrong about that. So the story is, I think, centers around, I think it does anyway, this marriage event. Now I've got to have my glasses. Which you can kind of see it. Once again, I said the camera pans and it's pointed to the groom at the end of chapter 3, I think it is. And the assumption is that there is a consummation of the marriage in chapter 4, all right? And that comes from chapter 4:12. He says she's a garden enclosed, and then in verse 16, she invites him to come and blow upon my garden. And in verse chapter 5, he speaks and says, I have come to my garden, my sister. So there's a sense of consummation there. But the wedding scene might start in chapter 3, verse 6. Coming up out of the wilderness, pillars of smoke, perfumed incense. Behold, it's Solomon's couch with 60 valiant men around it. With the valiant of Israel, they hold swords, they're expert in war, and so on. So you see this is like the equivalent of the bride coming down the aisle, perhaps, but it's Solomon instead. Now, he begins to speak in chapter 4, verse 1, and I would just presume that this might be the wedding night. That's the way it's often described. And he is trying to tell her that he loves her. And he's trying to comfort her and make her feel safe. So some of the things he says, and I think I've in verse 1 through 7, he says, you're very beautiful, right? And he goes through a list of things. Interesting, in their later lovemaking afterwards, instead of 7 wonderful things, he lists 10 wonderful things. That's a neat thing. She sees more in her, not less, you know, after this is over. This later in the book. But anyway, in chapter 4, verse 8, he says this interesting thing. He says, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's den and the mountains of the leopards. Now, this is weird language, okay? Well, what's the general sense that he's saying? They're not actually in the mountains. This may surprise you. She is not actually on top of Mount Hermon, and there are no literal lions running around. What is his point with this kind of imagery and poetry? What's he saying to her? I will protect you. Come out of the realm of insecurity and danger, and you will be safe with me. I think that's the point. Very picturesque language, right? So first he praises her beauty. He promises her security. And I would note here, especially for women, this is a footnote here, that both of these two things illustrate that there's a holistic relationship that forms the envelope for the sexual relationship. We have totally lost that in our culture. I believe we've lost most of the joy of sexual intercourse because of that, to be honest. I don't quite understand. But anyway, I think the security is a good part of that. And the difference between men and women, you've often heard this, that women will give sex to get love. Men will give love to get sex, right? So there's this sense of, I'm not really wanting to give this to you, but I will in order to get the more valuable thing. And so there's a sense in which the groom says, I promise you safety. I promise you protection and security. And then in 9 and 10, he says, you just do things to me. I'm deeply in love. You've ravished my heart. You've ravished my heart. One look of your eye, one looking for the link of your necklace. How fair is your love? How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes and so on. You see, he's saying, you have an enormous effect on me. And I don't think it's just a physical thing. He's just saying that's important. And finally, in verse 12, to me, the most moving thing, he says about her, you are a garden enclosed, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. What is the significance of that? Why would you? That doesn't sound very complimentary. What, did she have constipation? What's going on here? In what sense is she enclosed? That's unique and special and protected. And you can tell that. Look down. When you get to the, she's shut up, a fountain sealed up, verse 16, she invites him in. Come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. And then chapter 5, verse 1, he does come to his garden. He says that. But if you look over in chapter 8 near the end, she starts to talk about her little sister a little bit. And she says, I have a little sister. By the way, I mean, there's so many points to make. In the latter part of the book, they start thinking about other people and how their relationship can be beneficial. I think they go back and visit the mom's house, but it's hard to tell that for sure. But now she's worried about her relatives and what's going to be done for them. And I hope they'll get the same relationship that we've had.
And she mentions
verse 2. So is that a visit home? I don't know. But anyway, I guess he has good relationships with his in-laws. I don't know. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day she is spoken for? You know what she's talking about? She's going to get married one day, but not yet. She's too young. You can tell by her body that she's not very old yet. If she's a wall, now here we are being shut up again. See that? She will build on her, a battlement of silver. She's a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. Okay? Is it possible some girls are walls and some girls are doors and you might need to protect some by boarding them up? And others, you just celebrate their virtue and you know how they've lived and so on. Interesting, she goes on to say this. Look, she says, I am a wall. How does she know that about herself? Well, she knows it about herself, but Solomon tells her that too. Her husband does. And my breasts are like towers. And then, I'm reading New King James. I like the NIV some ways in this. But anyway, it says, then I became in his eyes. Whose eyes? Whose eyes? Her husband's eyes. As one who found peace. There's an interesting play on words there. Do you know what the Hebrew word for peace is? Shalom. And do you know the name that actually comes from the word shalom? Solomon. Right. She's kind of like, almost like saying, I brought peace. Or maybe I became Mrs. Solomon. I don't know. Could be that. But what she says is there's this great protection that she had. And so he praises her purity. Chapter 4, verse 12. Seems to me there's a little bit of I don't want to make it a formula, but guys probably like formulas. Maybe we need step-by-step instructions. I don't know. But this isn't a bad start to kind of help with building a romance in a relationship. That's assuming you can build it. And I think we should assume that. Praise or beauty, right? And you need to say that, in the jumping down to this third point, you have an effect on me. You're still as precious to me as when we first got married. And I won't betray you, and I trust that you won't betray me, and I will take care of you no matter what. Now, we say all that in the wedding vows, don't we? That part. I wonder if we really mean it. But why do we not? Can we not repeat those things? I think this groom here knows that that's the secret to winning her heart and building that romantic feeling toward him. Okay. Remember, I'm not just talking about sexual attraction. I'm talking about, it's not the sensation. Remember that C.S. Lewis reference that I didn't make a footnote for? It's about the person. It's about a oneness that you have with each other. And I think you build that with these things. Praising her beauty. Promise her that she has security in this relationship. You're not going to be among the lions. I'm not going to take advantage of you. And you have this effect on me. I have this great affection. And not only that, you are worth a lot. Your great virtues are to be praised. That reminds me, by the way, of what Christ did for the church. Right? When he sanctified and he glorified and all those things that we're told husbands are supposed to do in an analogous way. There's some suggestions, right, for enhancing romantic ship. All right, I'm feeling a little bit of time pressure here. So romantic love probably does aim a little bit more at the sexual thing. I think Scott may have mentioned, you may have made a reference to one of these or some of this before. This is in chapter 5 of Proverbs. Now we're into the book that's written to the young men, perhaps, right? And one of the dangers that men will have is to make these stupid decisions about sexual sin. And really, I think, you know, chapter 7 is a pretty good, that's not the right word, analysis maybe, of all the ways that this harlot is going to attract the young man. I don't think that's what the purpose of this course is, but it's not bad to look through there and look at where she is and how she talks and how she touches him and the way she compliments him and the way she says you'll never get caught and the way she's dressed and all that. Those are all things that we should be able to watch for, but that's not what this course is about. But this is what it says about romantic love in the context of marriage. What does it mean, drink water from your own cistern, running waters from your own well? Do you know what would that... It's clearly poetic language. By the way, I think this is true adult material, because only adults can understand it. Not because it's kind of schoolboy vulgarity. That's what we usually label as adult material. But I think it's something only kind of adults can understand. What does it mean, your own cistern, your own well? We should probably... Yeah, there's this... It's only shared with her. And she's not shared with someone else. Your springs don't overflow, and you're not drinking water from somebody else's streams as well. So there's this uniqueness, this special relationship. One of the secrets is it is private. And there's a sense of privacy that goes beyond not engaging in it with somebody else. I think there's a secrecy that goes with that. You don't need to share what's going on with the buddies, you know. Here's what... That's a sense of security that you need to understand. Let your fountain be blessed. Plentiful. I had to start with peas on this for some reason, but well. Satisfy or rejoice. It's pleasurable. And this is where it came up this morning. It's a huge pleasure. Always and ever be captivated. I hope you noticed the parallelism in here. I think this might be the NIV. May you ever be captivated by her love. Is that a good thing, that you're captivated by her love? You're captured. And that's parallel to the word in the next line, which is what? A negative thing. Is that a good thing, that you're captivated by an adulteress? That's not a good thing. It's a terrible thing. In fact, I have to say this. Can that latter line be addicting? Where you get into a habit and you cannot get out of it, and you get into the cycle of reward and feedback, and I'm tempted again, and I'm gratified, and that reinforces it, and I get into this loop of habit. Can that happen with an adulteress or some other immorality? Of course it can. Can you make that happen in your own marriage? If you did, there's the same word used there. If you did, would that be a good thing? where you kind of like start to feel withdrawal after a while if you don't have that relationship. And I don't necessarily just mean sexual, but I mean that companionship. Would that be a good thing, to start to feel uncomfortable and feel withdrawal and feel like, you know, do y'all see what I'm getting at? I think that this idea of being pleasurable has this other piece to it. I don't have the time to draw the little habit thing, but you know how habits work. You do something, you maybe have never done it before, and it's pleasurable. And that pleasure goes into your memory, and that memory is associated with that, whatever it is. Let's make it a cigarette. Anybody here ever smoked? No, don't raise your hand. Doesn't matter. It's a terrible thing nowadays, but when I was little, it wasn't. But, you know, but at some point, after you get over all the coughing and the stomach aches and the headaches and everything else like that, you kind of get used to it, and it's quite pleasurable. And that pleasure is stuck in your head. You know this about other habits, and I won't bring them up. Oh, I know one. No, we're filming. I won't do that. But anyway, you know that when you do something, it's pleasurable. And that's in your memory, and it brings you back to that. So the next time you're tempted again, because that pleasure is stuck as a powerful stimulant in your memory. Y'all know what I'm talking about? And you do it again, and it's stronger. And so that habit cycle gets built. Very hard to break. And so addictions are just like that. That's what happens, is that your mind, and not only your chemistry too, but your mind is working against you. Because you've got that memory of that pleasure, good or bad, is stuck in there and it's bringing you back. I guess I'm just trying to say, could you develop that kind of habit with your wife? I think this is suggesting that might be a good goal, actually. And so there's that dependence on one another. Now, that doesn't mean it'll always be there. And you don't build your marriage on it. We've already talked about that. And if it goes away, you deal with that. But it's not a good thing. It's just something you have to deal with. It's not a pleasant thing. So I'm kind of back to Scott's question about there's some things that are just plain old pleasurable. I'm trying to say, let's use that. Let's get ourselves addicted to that pleasure as part of the thing that keeps us faithful and part of the thing that builds the relationship and the security in our relationship. Now, I already showed you that you just can't go and do that without a larger context of security and respect and other things. But keep that in place, and then let's make this as addictive as we can. What does 1 Corinthians 7 say is one of the purposes for marriage, after all? Because of fornications, right? Let each man have his own wife. And he even goes on to say, let's don't defraud one another, to use old-timey language, right? You know, because we're not our own. Okay, that's... I'm trying to put... Thank you. I'm trying to put romance in the context here. And of course, permanent. Ever captivated, that's the idea. All right, this was the assessment I hope you were trying to do, and I've kind of grouped it in. Oh, wait, no, I just want to finish. I want to finish that point a little bit. One more thing. So here's what I'm trying to summarize a little bit, and that is there a place for, I'll speak a little roughly here, raw sexual desire in marriage? Is there a place for that? Is it at the top of our pyramid or the bottom of our pyramid? Do we build anything on that, or is it built on everything else? You see what I'm trying to say? And I think that's there as one. Maybe sometimes it's not even there. It may not even be part of it. And I'll just tell you, you might have a wife that has health problems or whatever, but still, it's there. And out of that is the romance, that is the protection and the stability for that. And in that is the commitment to marriage and the common goals that you have. And these are the stable things, not these. And it's built this way, not the other way. Having said that, can I control those emotions that are up there? By the way, they are volatile, right? Sometimes I just have a headache. I really have a headache, right? Or I ate something that I shouldn't have eaten. And I'm just not in the mood, or whatever your thinking is on that. It's just not going to be there. That doesn't matter. Those are the less stable blocks, right? I can handle that. The stable ones remain, that are built on love and sacrificial of this picture that we had of Christ. That's what that is. And then, but boy, if I can make that more pleasurable, it's helping. It's a how, though, it's not a why. That's my point. Okay. I ask you to fill this out. I really think that building our character, especially as we move into being head of a wife and head of a family, has to be built on our own spirituality. I hope you read all these and looked through these. Did you have a chance to do this? Did you come back and do this? Okay. I'm not going to take the time necessarily to do it, but there are three of these. Here they are. One is, actually, I am going to go through this. I think there's just so much practical stuff here. And you maybe should just put an X by the ones that are a problem for you instead of checking. I'm sure all of these are good checks for you guys. But I think that if you don't do something differently as a result of having been here in your life, maybe we've wasted our time. You might want to pick one of these to try to improve, or two or three. Let's talk about some of these. Look, spirituality. This is, you love the Lord your God with all your heart. It's the basis of everything else, of the sacrificial, that's the second one, and the skills and strength. Do you believe that God exists? Jesus is His Son. Do you believe the Bible's inspired? I pray often on my own. I study the Bible on my own. Do you see there's a core values? They don't have to do with anybody else, but they indicate what's at the heart of your character. I initiate family studies and devotions. I give sacrificially, my own personal sacrifice, including secret gifts. I'm an example of honesty in business and personal transactions. My personal habits are pure, and they're improving. I'm patient and calm, even when things go wrong or others are angry. I resist jealousy, covetousness, materialism, greed, pride, and desire for revenge. I'm an example of thinking and speaking the best of others and not judging motives prematurely. Do any of these hurt you, your conscience when you read them? If they are, put a little X by them and work. I'm an example of personal discipline in all aspects of life. Physical fitness, mental alertness, use of time, use of money, all of those things. And I have no offensive or detrimental habits. Okay, looking outward then. The first thing I think about in my decisions are what's best for my family. That's assuming you're in a headship position. I'm known for gentleness and care for all others around me. I'm going to use my laser pointer. I take time off or use days off for seeing to my wife and children's needs. I'm careful not to create a burden on my wife because of, are you ready? I can't be reached. I'm unavailable. I have an unpredictable schedule. I'm personally sloppy or some other self-centered activity. I mean, sometimes we have this feeling that, you know, it's just the way I am. I don't know what it is. My socks always fall in the middle of the living room. I can't explain it, but I can't change it either. It's just there. It happens. And there may be inconveniences. And the same thing, you should never be out of reach, right? There should be four or five numbers your wife can continue to call where somebody can come and find you. And I do not claim to have followed that. Okay? I'm just saying I feel terrible that I didn't. That there were times when it was important for her to call me and that I was not to be found. Because I was careless about letting... I frequently and voluntarily helped with the cooking, washing, cleaning, and managing kids. I offered to relieve my wife. I don't know why we're reluctant to do that. I mean, I don't know... We got this idea of what woman's work is. Maybe that's part of managing the house, but I don't know. But you should practice that. You might need to use it one day. I offer to relieve my wife of duties. I'm sensitive to her overload. I'm known for volunteering at church, especially to help the, guess what, the weak and needy. My personal hobbies and outings with the guys are subject to cancellation based on the desires and needs of my wife, and I'm not ashamed of that. Right? You ever been with the guys and the wife calls to ask for one of the guys and everybody lets him have it, right? Because his wife's checking on him and he's embarrassed to death. Okay? I'm never angry when my proposals are not approved or they're not followed. I never hold a grudge when others' mistakes keep me from getting my way. I give up job opportunities and job income for family time and service to others. I ask about my wife and children's needs and problems with calls and conversations. I'm known for my care and for my needy relatives. I'll just say back on that one, just an interesting personal story. My dad was very proud of this fact. Wherever he went, and he traveled a lot around the world, different places, he always called home every night. It's kind of interesting. And of course, he made that a habit and made that a kind of a trademark in a way. And that was a challenge in the days when there weren't cell phones and there weren't, you know, you had to remember a credit card number and another number or else call collect and all that. Of course, he worked for the phone company, so part of it was the pride that the phones would work from anywhere in the world. But there's some countries in Europe you had to find a post office, you know, and they'd let you in and you can make a call. That's the only way you could get a call placed. But he did that. Yes, so I'm known for my care for my needy relatives. Y'all got any of those that you have to take care of? My wife's car, clothes, housework tools are safer and better than mine. And I don't mean than your housework tools. I mean your other tools. Right? Is that, how's that going? I'm visible at school and serving. I've provided adequate life and health insurance at the sacrifice of my income. I plan our vacations and outings for the maximum benefit of my wife and children. I hope you see a little bit of the pyramid in this, right? And that is, it's not just about the pleasure. Everything we do has some aspect of helping others, serving others. I'm on very good terms with all who know me. I'm satisfied when others get the credit for success, even if I have been involved. And finally, skills and strength. And this is the area where maybe you got all these virtues knocked out, right? But here are some things that you will probably have to learn to do if you're younger or get better at over time. I'm going to stand back. How's your Bible knowledge? Do you have good Bible study tools? I think that's maybe an indicator. I know a lot of stuff's online, but it doesn't hurt to have some good books that you can just lay out on the table. How is your library, by the way? You have several versions of the Bible. Are they marked up? They got good wide margins. Evidence of study, that's a pretty good symptom of that. And here's a test. My family often asks me, where is that verse? Or what does the Bible say about this or that? And I'm able to answer. I know some families where the wife can answer those questions very well, but maybe the husband can't. That'd be a test. I often initiate spontaneous Bible discussions, right? Skipping on down. My physical condition is robust enough that I can easily accomplish required activities with energy and strength to spare to care for others. That's in the pyramid. I think physical fitness, if you can do it, if you have an illness, you just deal with that. But those are things within our control. And they probably reflect a sense of discipline. I'm competent to fix cars and home appliances. I earn adequate income to support my family because that's the purpose of it. I understand finances, budgeting, insurance, taxes, investing to whatever level's needed. Here's one. I manage our expenses to be well within our income, including our liberal contributions, short-term emergency funds, and so on. I am the one who resolves the conflicts between my wife and myself, and even between members of our extended family. Y'all don't have any conflicts in your extended family, I wouldn't guess, right? Nobody would have that. Are you known as a peacemaker? Blessed are the peacemakers. One who does that. By the way, a lot of skill required in that, I would think, if you're good at it. I've studied my wife's strengths, and I understand her fears and hopes. I find ways to help her excel in areas of service where she's suited. And I know each of my children, their strengths, their weaknesses, their uniquenesses. And I know how to teach, advise, protect, comfort, encourage, and warn them, and so on. So you assess those, and you might feel like some of those are a little difficult. All right, roles of a father. Let's see, how can I budget this? We have till 5, right? All right. We're going to try to go get this done by maybe 25 till, I think that would be. The next section is not very, very long, and we'll have some time. Got to reset a little bit. I think there's one fundamental thing about rearing children that makes Christians different from everybody else that approaches that issue. And it's not so much the techniques at all, but it's one fundamental underlying assumption. And we've already talked about it. We started the whole course with this idea. And that is, we are at war. I don't think that's the world view of things. Look at some of these passages. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. That's outside. Beloved, I beg you, sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. That's inside. Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, so when they speak against you, that's outside. As evildoers, they may by your good works which they observe glorify God. Down to Philippians 2. You become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. among whom you serve. Do you think that generally people in the world see the world as crooked and perverse? Maybe they do, but not in the sense that we do. It's usually in a way that big government or some socialist program will solve if we could just elect the right people. I'm just telling you, we live in a fallen world. I don't care what politics you have, Engel fixed the world. That's what we learn from the book of Genesis and these other passages. What will fix the world is Christ and changing hearts individually, but I don't think that will happen. That's just not what Jesus prophesied would happen. And yet that's the effort that we're in. That's the war we're in. I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see a different law in my members. By the way, law there I think is used as the idea of an influence, a forcing function, a principle, as in a law of physics or something. Warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity in the law of sin which is in my members. Are children going to grow up in this world of war? That's where they are growing up, right? Both outside and inside. All that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, of the eyes, the pride of life is not of the Father but is of the world. And we know that we are of God and the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord in the power of His might. This is the passage we keep referring to. It comes at the end of those family verses. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood but against principalities and powers, the rules of... Does this frighten you? A little bit. I mean, if you really believe it's so, I don't even know where these things are. I'm not even sure what they are, but they sound scary to me. They should anyway. The spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. We walk in the flesh, do not war according to the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity and the obedience of Christ. Is anybody in here a survivalist? Or is that the right word for it? You know what I mean by that? Pardon? Yeah, I think so. I haven't heard that term, but I think that's it. Yeah, right. Now, their thinking is the world is about to lose it, right? And they need to be prepared for that. Oh, I guess it's the case that if you were one of those, you wouldn't tell anybody here, would you? So you got your secret stash and all your weapons somewhere up out in the woods somewhere here. But you're not telling anybody that's going on because you need to be able to slip away, right? What's their point of view is the world is about to go nuts and we need to be prepared for that. And part of that preparation is separation. And part of that preparation is arming yourself in the way that will allow you to protect yourself from this world that's going to come after you and attack you. Do you see some of those words in here? And you know I'm not proposing that we should be preppers or whatever in a physical way. But does it affect the way you might rear your children if you were a prepper? Right? And the way you would teach them to view the outside world and the things to watch for in the outside world. Hey, when this happens, we're going to the fort or the cabin or whatever it is, right? You see what I'm talking about? This changes your mentality, it seems to me, about children and rearing children. Not to mention your own life, I think. I think you have to start with this point of view. Remember the spiritual goal of family relationships? I'm not going to go through the chart. What was it? Remember what it was? What was the spiritual goal for families led by Christians? What's the goal for the children? It's saving souls, right? That's what it is. As those are the verses. Okay, I want to talk about the current worldview. Let's talk about the world around us as a little bit of a contrast. And you can't hardly understand this without seeing the radically different view the world takes about what's going on with children. Okay? First of all, there's no supernatural. Humans have evolved, so there's no eternal spirit or anything like that. Religion is a human product. We invented it because we were afraid and we wanted something to kind of call on, or because we couldn't explain lightning. And so we said, well, there must be some bigger than life human who's bigger than me that makes lightning. That's our explanation for that. The goal of life is fulfillment, right? Obviously, that's all you got going on is I have to be happy and get something done. So I think with these four ideas, no supernatural, we're just animals, maybe evolved higher. Religion is a man-made product, and what you get out of life is what you can get out of it yourself, right? I think if you put those two ideas together, you have to conclude there's no intrinsic right or wrong. Now, in the world, you won't find this this view said much out loud. A few of the more advanced, courageous philosophers will say, you know, the way it all says is there's nothing right or wrong. You can say what you want, but there's no way to decide this thing is immoral and this other thing is moral. There's no basis for that. People don't live consistent with that, even the ones that even say it out loud. But that's kind of an underlying thesis, right? Animals, religion is made up. Christ in the Bible is not the only way. That's obvious. I mean, you can make up lots of other ways, right? If it's all made up anyway. And therefore, there really are no consequences for anything like sin, if there is such a thing. And finally, if I'm making up religion and the purpose of my life is just fulfillment, I just decide for myself what's right and wrong, and those choices got to be for my benefit, whatever's best for me, which is another way of saying you live for that bottom block called pleasing yourself, right, I think. Now, what about children? It seemed to me these two argue no intrinsic right or wrong, no consequences for sin. What right do you have as a parent to say something's right or wrong in a kid's life? I mean, really, on what basis? It's just a kind of highly evolved animal. And by the way, animals evolve to survive in the world, right? So really, the longer we evolve, the better suited we are already for the world. It's not as if the world is a hostile place that's going to hurt us somehow. We evolve to survive in the world. You see that? So don't mess with a kid's mind by telling him he can't do some things. Those are natural. Those are things that he evolved to survive in the world. You have no right. In fact, it might even be harmful to start telling him he can't do certain things, especially if there's nobody hurt, right? And so each child really has to find his own way in the world. And that's kind of the way you raise puppies, isn't it? I mean, if occasionally you can kind of train them not to go to the bathroom in the wrong place just for your convenience, but it's not a matter of moral right and wrong, is it? Nah. I mean, and you know, if you didn't do that, they'd kind of figure out there's some more appropriate places to do, because they have instincts and they're made to suit themselves in the world. You see what I'm talking about? We don't really worry about kittens and puppies and wild animals being trained and having moral choices or any of that. They're just suited for the world, right? That's what they live in. And if we see children in that way, we've ignored the fact that we are spiritual beings created in the image of God, and we are in a spiritual warfare, and we're walking amongst a hostile enemy. And if you forget that, you've kind of got it all wrong. And what I'm telling you is that fundamental assumption will change the whole way you think about rearing children. And I'm going to move along that path a little bit more. I went online just to see if I could find out what is good parenting in the eyes of the world. And I really didn't take very long. I should have taken longer. I could have found probably better quotes. But here's the ones I found. Prepare them to do well in this world. QED. That's what I was trying to demonstrate. This is what the ultimate goal of rearing children is, to do well in this world. I couldn't have said it better myself, right? Just do better in this world. Develop as fully engaged a person who is able to navigate through their own experience, get that, while feeling comfortable in their own skin. Besides just being stupid, I mean, but you see the point here, right? Is that the goal of parenting, to help kids feel comfortable in their own skin? That's the best you can come up with? Suited to the world? Teach a child to become self-sufficient, fully functioning, contributing adult member of society. Well, that's helpful. At least it has an outward look to it. Guide children toward developing a well-functioning personality led by an unhindered, true, capital S, self. Who's in charge? Who's making the decisions? It's the child. I favor well-being as the most important. Do you see any sense of conflict or danger or overcoming the world or winning the battle for your heart and soul within against the devil? There's none of that in that. No, just help them kind of get along and live with who they really are and those kind of things. I don't know if that impresses you that way too, but I thought that was an interesting set. Okay, so here I think happiness is the primary value. You got to figure it out yourself. Strive for balance. Don't go to extremes. And some things are just too hard. It's not a matter of right and wrong. You don't have to do this. All right. So I want to talk about fatherhood, and then I want to get to discipline maybe the next 10 minutes or so. I think this is true, but I'm not sure of this yet. But I think it's true that in the Old Testament, God is not so much presented as a father. There are a couple of references that I can find where God says that he treated the Israelites as if they were a son. It's the way it's phrased. I might be wrong about that. But he doesn't say they are my sons. I think it may be in Moses, or maybe it's in Deuteronomy, early Deuteronomy. And there's another couple of places where he treated them. But this a man appeared on the scene, and he started using words like this. My Father who is in heaven. Right? And then he started saying, your Father. Who was that? That was Jesus. It's like, what? What is he saying? And then he prays and he says, our Father who art in heaven. Right? And there's some sense in which God could be a father and we could be children. Not as a father, but a father. I don't know, but it just seems like the language Jesus uses is somehow radical when he shows up in that early part of Matthew and starts using the term father. I think now we begin to see that God is a pattern for fatherhood. Maybe we saw that all along. But here are some of the patterns of fatherhood that we see. These are two fathers. Don't provoke to wrath. Don't discourage children, which is that may be the opposite of that. You do things until they just lose their temper or they get angry or they just give up, maybe the other extreme. You chasten them for the best profit. You show love by timely discipline. We'll talk about that more later. You're teaching them every day when you're rising up and sitting down. You have the teaching of the law so present that it is as if you'd pasted it on the wall of your house, right? Or wore it between your eyes, or had it strapped to your body somehow. You give instructions and train for later years. And Paul's example was that in 1 Thessalonians, which we read earlier, Stephen read the mother-father example. This is the way he looked. He was devout, just, blameless, exhorted, comforted, and charged. Here's God's pattern of a father. This is an extract of a much longer list. But look at some of these qualities and start to think about as a father. Now, you know this, right? When you have a small child, they think you are, I don't know if this is the right term or not, but they think you're God in a way. I don't mean to say that in any blasphemous way, but they think you can do anything. And they think you know everything. We soon disabuse them of that, but they think they really respect that. Now, if you're abusive or some way, they will soon learn the rest of the story. They may still think you're just an abusive God, right? But still, there's this respect that you almost get for free. And so they're looking at you, and maybe in some ways we look at God and we want to say God is like, you know what? He is perfect. He never makes a mistake, right? Be ye perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect, Jesus said. He's holy. There's nothing about him that has ever any hint of evil. He never tempts in any way, right? Let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God, for God tempts no one, neither is he tempted, right? There's no unrighteousness, no variation or shadow cast by turning, James 1, right? There's no lies or vacillation. Let every man be a liar, but God is true. That's how truthful he is. He's severe and good. He's just and kind. He judges without partiality. And I would just say if many of those passages are about how we should be like God, or because God is this way, we should live in a holy way, for example. Keep on going. You may have noticed that these are all intrinsic natures of God. This is like our similar to spirituality. These are intrinsic nature. But he always is working for our benefit, right? If God is for us, who's against us? He gives gifts to men. He leads and protects from stumbling. He chastens us for our profit. He bears us through trouble, Deuteronomy 1. He's unconditional in his blessings given. He's peaceable and treatable, pities, mercies, draws unfaithful with his love. He gives comfort and hope. He loves us enough to adopt us. He loves us while we're enemies, etc., etc. I would just tell you this is that very same three things. There are the intrinsic qualities of God. There's his benevolent nature. And then, in the bottom over here, is this omniscience almost, where he is aware of all of our needs. He has our deep wisdom and knowledge. He sees and knows all. He can do all things. He's able to do above our expectation. Who can live up to that? Who in here can do that? Never once inconsistent. Never once a hint of evil would ever be the cause of someone to do something wrong. Knows exactly what someone needs. In fact, knows everything. Omniscient. Past, present, and future. How many of you are like that? And yet God is our pattern of fatherhood. And so my question to you is this. Is there any way we can somehow try to approach this as our model? Like we were thinking about Christ in the church as head over the body. Is there some way that we could be better at seeing and knowing all things, for example, omniscience, as fathers of our children? Is there anything we could do to improve our knowledge of our children and what they do and how they feel and what tempts them, right? And what they like, how they're rewarded. You see that? You go investigate. And we're imperfect, but I think if we could think of these things, I will never be a source of anything unholy. And I think about anything I do, and I measure it against that purity and that holiness, right, against God. I think that's one thing that comes with Jesus calling God our Father, and He says, you be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. And it calls on us to actually then try to emulate the qualities of God, which I think had these three characteristics. So, I have this little worksheet for you, another one. We'll take just a minute or two and just have you fill that out. In fact, we'll read it together and you can fill it out. I'm never an influence toward evil. Ever. I'm truthful and honest, not hypocritical or inconsistent. These are right out of those texts. With regard to my children now. This is not a wife thing. This is children. I'm fair, impartial, sound, and accurate judge of their character. I am intolerant of evil. I punish but for the good of the child. I'm smart, observant, wise, aware of the needs of others. I provide for all their needs physically. I give gifts, including time, when asked. I lead, protect, provide strength. I pity, sympathize, show mercy. I am slow to anger. I draw children with love. I'm easy to entreat. I comfort them in pain. I give them hope. I love sacrificially, even when they don't deserve it. I'm powerful in their eyes, for sure. I'm competent, energetic, effective, respected, and successful. I don't provoke them to anger. I teach God's word. I don't know why that's not capitalized. I provide practical wisdom and knowledge about this world. So what I would suggest, more exercises for home. Pick three of those areas to improve and think about some actions this week that would make you more knowledgeable or increase the power you have to fix things or that would make you more open to being approached as a close father. We're going to skip over this. You can do that if you want. These are categories. I think you should picture your child at 35. And what are those most important? The trick in this, though, is don't use more than five of any number. So you can't have five where everything's important. Use only five of the number one priorities. Okay. I do want to talk about this. We claim that the most important thing we want for our children is we would love for them to be saved, to be faithful Christians, productive Christians, that are not only saving themselves, but saving others. Right? And that is a way higher priority than over whether they make a lot of money in their life, isn't it? Isn't it? Y'all agree with that? How do we express those priorities to them? Oh, yeah, I just tell them. They get it when I tell them, right? Y'all understand what I'm trying? I'm going to get to this easy point. I think you understand. Now, I don't think children see things very subtly. Right? I don't mean quite that they only see it in black and white. I mean it's just kind of a very upfront message when we do things. And so, I think when you try to, well, I mean, I can give some examples. You know, what are we spending our time and effort as a family doing? What do we talk about overall when we're together? What's the main topic we talk about? Yeah, there's a little football in there, there's a little politics, but what is the main thing we talk about? What is the preparation and provisions that we're making? What are the failures that we worry the most about or that maybe even upset us the most? What are the choices we make when our two priorities are in conflict? What is the eagerness, that the things that we like to do versus the things that we dread? And by the way, that comes right through in our body language and our enthusiasm and things like that. And kids see that. I would tell you they see these more than when you tell them, going to church is the most important thing we do, studying the Bible. Well, let's show that in our enthusiasm or in our priorities. And I'll tell you, we make sacrifices in what it's so easy for us to give this up. We really were hoping for that new car, but we can't afford it. It's no big deal. We didn't get it. Okay? Or I was hoping for this new job in this new town, make a lot more money. Didn't get it. No big deal. So the way we react to things, but there are other things that we give up that are really important to us. The way you show those priorities, I think, is what you tell them plus how you live. And I think the messages are kind of simple and crude is what I guess I'm trying to say. So if I've made a choice to sacrifice the Tuesday night baseball game because there's a meeting at church, what you probably want to know is it a sin in and of itself to miss one night of the meeting, right? Okay, so, and maybe you can work your way through that. I don't know, maybe you can, right? Maybe you can say, yeah, I was going to preach on something. I've already heard that lesson, so it won't help me spiritually as much as being with these other people, and maybe I'll invite somebody to church while I'm at the game, and you're going to just, you know, lawyer your way right out of that, okay? What's the kid going to see? Those subtleties are lost, I'm telling you. They're just a simple message. It may not even be what you intended, but it's a simple message. And I'm just saying to you that setting priorities and living the priorities, that's the way they're communicated. And it's the very simple, rudimentary messages that come from that. So here's how we do it. How do we measure our academic? What are you the most upset about? A C in algebra, right? Or did not doing Bible lessons? They learn from that. Diligence for Bible study and devotions versus piano practice. I'm paying a lot for those lessons, by the way. Praise and criticism for performance in sports versus moral behavior or Bible knowledge or demonstrated character when it's tough. What gets the most praise? Stylishness versus modesty in dress. What are we buying for them? Our emphasis on sleep for school versus Sunday morning study. Right? You don't want to stay up too late because we got school the next day. On the other hand, we don't want to work too hard. Sunday morning, we'll stay up late. Saturday night, doesn't matter if you're tired for that service. Now, I'm not addressing necessarily the right or wrong of this. I'm just telling you that these are messages to children. You can argue your way out of this and say, yeah, but. But I'm telling you, to a kid, it's a simple message. And they learn it at an early age. What do we talk about? While we're, quote, Deuteronomy language, in the way, in the quantity of what we talk about, in the emotional fervor that we talk about it. What do we praise at the Sunday lunch conversation? Right? The roast preacher conversation. Reading materials and other media that's in the home. Who are our heroes? Who do we want to be like? Who are the ones that are their pictures are up in our study or in our home in some way? Or we know all about their history and their batting average and their home team and their background and all that. So y'all understand, I'm going to say this again. You're wanting to know, do you think it's a sin to? But you've heard that before, right? You know the answer to that. I'm not kind of on that topic. I'm on the topic of what's the kid seeing? That's what I'm asking. It's a simple message. It's very overt. And that's the level at which they'll reason about things. What do we get excited about? Where do we plan our vacations and what do they plan to accomplish? Right? What effort are we spending to be with Christians? I think in our family, we had Christians that are spread all over Atlanta. And if you know anything about Atlanta, you know, and being 5 miles away can be a long way at certain times of day. But, I mean, I think you can see some families that said, you know what, you want to be with other Christians, we'll figure out how to do it. Right? We will just figure that out because that's important. And that's who we want your friends to be and that kind of thing. What is the sacrifices we make? What are we most insecure about in our life? What effort do we make to get to Bible classes, which set habits? Are we pushing them, on the other hand, to participate in what you would think of as purely social things? Or we rationalize those things? I mean, do you think it's a sin too? Can you catch that? To go to the prom. What do you think? Is it a sin to go to the prom? You all know how to answer that question now, right? What do you ask? What's the answer? Yeah, why do you want to go? But still, I think there's a message in that. So you know what? We're gonna work around this a little bit and figure out, well, okay, so maybe you won't be involved in the dancing and, you know not to go anywhere afterward and all that kind of, right? And you want to be part of the social environment. You don't want people to think you're weird or whatever it is. There's a message in there. That's the point. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's talk about principles and discipline. Skip over all these. You know these. I think you know the Hebrews 12 passage. the motive, why you do it, and what the goal is. All right. Now, I'm going to go back to Proverbs again. Proverbs written to a young man. And what are the two quantities, things that are contrasted all throughout the book of Proverbs? It's really just kind of like two kinds of living that are contrasted there. Foolishness and wisdom, or if you want to say the fool and the wise man, say it that way. I think sometimes we believe, and maybe it's used this way in some places, that the fool and the wise man, it's just a matter of kind of like good and best. Like if you want to get by in the world and succeed and have lots of friends and influence people and make lots of money and be at peace and be healthy, then you live in a wise way. On the other hand, you can do stupid things and you'll pay for it. It's a little like stepping on a rake and it bops you in the head and that hurts and that's just stupid. That's foolish. You shouldn't have done that, and that's a dumb way to live, right? So as if it's something about expedience or something. And another thought is this, that wisdom, how many of you have heard wisdom defined as it's the ability to apply knowledge? So the theory is that you pile up all these facts, right? You have to be old to get a lot of them, by the way. You pile them all up, and then you look at them and you say, ah, now I see the principles involved here. And so that's wisdom. Now I know how to apply them, or I now have to do something with all these facts. So that's how we know the difference between knowledge and wisdom. If you will just tolerate me and purge that from your mind for the next few minutes, that's not what the kind of wisdom I think is presented in the Proverbs really is. One of the reasons I think that is that in order to have that kind of wisdom, you have to be old or older to collect all those facts and synthesize them and make sense of them, don't you? There's an interesting passage, I think it will come up, in the book of Ecclesiastes where it says, a young man can be wiser than an old king. How can that be? Wait a minute, he didn't know all these facts yet. I'm going to assert to you that wisdom is a little bit more than that. We think of the wise man, and you know where you find wise men. They're up on a mountain. They're always up on a mountain, right? And they always do this with their hands, right? And you say, is this bird dead or alive? You ever heard that question, right? And if he says it's dead, then what do I do? I open it, it's alive. If he says it's alive, what do? I kill it and I open my hand. And only the wise man on the mountain can tell the answer to that question, right? That is not what the picture in the Proverbs is of a wise man. Now, I'm going to give you a snapshot of that right quick because I think it's important. Here are some passages that contrast wise and foolish people. The wise in heart accepts commands. Wait. I thought he was edicting things. I thought he was emanating wisdom, right? No, he's accepting commands versus the fool. By the way, that Hebrew word is probably some kind of onomatopoeia that kind of reminds us of somebody that does this. Ah, you ever done that? So you can't hear anything? He's chattering. He's making noises as the opposite of listening, right? That's kind of the idea. Fool spurns a parent's discipline. Whoever heeds correction shows prudence. How long will you... who are simple, love your simple ways, delight in mockery, hate knowledge, no pleasure in understanding, delight in airing your own opinions. You get a picture there? Is the wise man the one who's always saying wise things or the one who is listening to hear wise things? Which is it? It's really the latter. It's a listener, not a talker. Let's look at this. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and knowledge. The way of the fool seems right to them, but what? The wise say wise things. No. They listen to advice. And now you can begin to see, can a young man be wise? Yeah, because look what it takes. You listen to correction. You accept commands. You fear the Lord. You listen to advice. That's what wise is. Those who trust in themselves are fools. That's what it is. And those who walk in wisdom are kept safe. Okay. The fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but he delights in what? Talking. Saying what he knows, as if he knows it all. Gathers crops in the summer, is prudent. Sleeps during the harvest, is disgraceful. Here's the lazy person, which I think is in the camp of the fool. He turns on his bed, that's motion without displacement. He's too lazy to bring it back to his mouth when he finds something that he's fixed to eat. He's wiser in his own eyes than seven people who answer discreetly. Keep those in mind, by the way. So it's not just a matter of talking a lot. It's what you think of your own opinion and what you think of other people's opinions, that especially that contradict or correct yours. A longing fulfilled is sweet to the soul. Fools detest turning from evil. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Okay, now let's think about that. Can children be wise or foolish? Yes. There's this reference I was telling you about. Better is a poor but wise youth. By the way, the fact that he's poor means he probably didn't go to college yet, or maybe ever. He's not even educated, but he's a young man, but he's wiser than a king. Why is that? Because it's really more about character than it is about the assimilation of facts and knowledge. So really, look at Proverbs. What you got really is a contrast of two ways of living. And one is self-centered, and one is open to God and His wisdom through its many sources. God Himself, as well as fathers and the fool's vineyard next door and other sources, nature and other things. That's what the difference is in Proverbs. It's the fool who doesn't listen. So let's define folly then. I will say this about the fool. He hates laws. He's not bound by authority. He hates instruction and reproof, and he will not change. He doesn't listen. He doesn't learn. He trusts his own opinion. He likes to hear himself, not others. He's short-sighted or carnally minded. He avoids work. He's attracted to sin, and he denies spiritual realities. Did you see all that in those verses? I hope you did. You can go back and see if they're there. Okay. So, if I were to transfer that into maybe the behavior of children sometimes, I would see these things. Do you see them? Rebellion and disobedience, disrespect, stubbornness, self-centeredness, selfishness, laziness, right? Laziness or carelessness, that's the short-sightedness. Or even obvious evils, right? So this immorality thing, things that relate to doing sin or denying the spiritual realities. And those would include things like cruelty to others, dishonesty, and profanity. Okay. Here's the passage I want you to remember about this, because I think it's a more revealing passage than the earlier verse in the chapter, verse 6, which says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. You know that verse, don't you? It's on lots of macrames and cross stitches, I guess. But this one, it probably isn't. I don't know. Here are several translations. Folly is bound up, tangled up, the Holman Christian Standard says, in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline, the rod of correction will what? Drive it from him, remove it far from him, drive it from him. Rod of and reproof give wisdom. A child left to himself brings shame to his mother. This seems to be saying that the purpose of discipline is to remove something that's already there in the child. It's entangled up in his heart. And there's some effort required to disentangle that and pull it out and purge it from him. You see that? Is that what this is saying? And discipline, probably including physical, corporal punishment, is used for that, to remove that. And what it is that's bound up in his heart is folly. And now we know what folly is, right? It's when you don't listen, or when you don't have, when you have an instruction, you rebel against it, or when you correct it and you hate it, right? Or when you know better and you're lazy. You see that? I'm really in more of a position to understand the nature of discipline. So I'm going to skip these. These are interesting, but not. Here's some test cases. Is this folly or not? A two-year-old refuses to come at his parents' request. Remember our definition of folly? It was like rebellion, it was this or that. Okay. Parent says come, and the two-year-old doesn't come. What do you think? Folly or not? Is there any minority opinion on that? Yes. Okay.
You have to train them first before.
Okay. Here's the point. If I don't have a rule that says you have to come when I say come, and they don't come, is that really rebellion? You know what I'm saying? If I haven't said, hey, here's the law, and listen to this, and they didn't listen, that's foolishness. If they didn't have them to listen to, I'm not sure I'd put it in that category. You understand, there's a little bit of context here. A five-year-old does not put on a seatbelt. Same thing, right, in a way. I mean, if there's a law and a consequence, right? Now, maybe they got to be five and never wore one before. I don't know. That's kind of hard to believe. Four-year-old trips and hurts baby sister, folly or not? Now, baby sister is hurt for sure, right? But maybe not. Four-year-old spills milk for the third time at dinner. folly or not.
So
there's depends behind all of these. I think you're catching on this point. There may have actually been a rule that says we don't put our milk right at the edge of the table, right? Or underneath the arm you're eating with, or I don't know what it is, right? And so that's resulted in this. So there is not the spilling of the milk, it's the other thing that had a law against it and so on. Okay, I can keep on going. I just want to say this. So I think that there's some age in which a child, I can just let you look at these if you want to, where you begin to see that there's that folly showing up. When a child is first born, how well do they listen to you? How much do they make noise? Right? How self-centered are they when they're first born? That's all they know. They don't have any other world, right? And they don't listen, and they scream all the time, and their own needs, they're wet, they're hungry, they're whatever's wrong with them, their stomach hurts. That's the center of their world, and they complain about that a lot. Very self-centered, right? Do they cause mommy and daddy inconvenience and pain and loss of sleep and all that? And do they even care? I don't guess they do. Now, I'm not saying that's folly, but you see that begins their world. And so there comes a time in their world where they become more aware that there's something else out there. There's maybe some rules. There's some behaviors that I can choose. Even though I can physically do them, I have to choose whether to do them or not. And that choice kind of may mean something. Now, a puppy dog doesn't worry about that. If it's instinctive, that's what they do, right? But maybe there's some sense of discipline there. And so my illustration, I always use it, is the peas on the... And Timothy, or Miriam, sent me some pictures of little Mary with the peas on her tray doing this. But you know, children experiment. They experiment with gravity, as a matter of fact. And peas, which are nice little BBs, they can roll around on the tray. They go like that, and they go over the side. But to be sure, to be a real scientist, you know what you have to do. Yeah. That's pretty good. So you do that. Now, is that folly? It's putting peas on the floor. It's putting food on the floor. Right? But there's probably some age. When is it? I don't know. Some kids, 9 months? I don't really know. But it looks more like this. Right? And so is there still experiments going on here? Right? But you see the difference in that experiment? Now who's it? Now what are we trying to learn about? It's not the law of gravity anymore. I want to see if that rule that I heard about and maybe got a little hand slap before last night is still working today. And this begins to look like that folly a little bit, doesn't it? Where I didn't really like that rule. And I want to test it and see if I can not do it because I don't really like it. I like to put peas on the floor and watch them fall. And so begins to be this kind of a test of will. But I think that helps us understand that verse. That's bound up in the heart of a child. And by the way, there'll be another experiment the following day, and it'll be on some other issue, but it'll be at the church building. And I wonder if the same rules that we have at home apply at the church building in front of all the other Christians, right? And the next day it'll be at the supermarket. You know what I'm saying here. So there's this whole world of experimentation, which is quite natural. But what you're seeing is the child trying to understand the boundaries. The rules for punishment are, it's for driving out folly. And folly is defined as rebellion. You can't rebel against a rule you don't know, or you haven't been told, or against a standard that you haven't been helped to understand. Does everybody see that? So, I'll talk some other things here. So it should be for folly. It should be associated with personal guilt, not for the crowd. For somebody broke the vase, so everybody's going to get a spanking for that. Certain when promised. False threats and second chances just teach that there will be false threats and second chances, right? And teaching that really it's the third or sometimes the fourth warning that's the one you have to listen to, because unless the third one gets to 110 decibels, if it does, that's the last chance you're going to get. They learn all that. They're good at that. They know what the thing is. So it's not helping at all. Near in time to the infraction, it's got to be more painful than the thing they got to enjoy through that folly and that rebellion, or else it's not a good choice. But it should be over quickly, forgotten once done. I just want to tell you a few minutes. There is an antimatter world to punishment. You're probably aware of that. That really all these things apply to. What's the opposite of punishment? That really has all these same characteristics. There ought to be reward. And in the ideal, which would you like to have more of? The reward, of course. I wonder if we do that, if we maybe do that. The reward is praise for non-folly. There's another word for that, for wisdom. There's a whole extra section you'll see in the charts if you want to get them on teenagers, but how they demonstrate that they are becoming wise. I think it's a good way to look at it. Think about the qualities of wisdom as Proverbs defines them. Look for them in the teenager and help them find ways to demonstrate that they are listeners, that they seek advice, for example, and other things like that. It's for personal goodness. It's certain. If you promise a reward, it happens. It's near the good behavior. It's pleasurable. Now, here's the one that's different. In the case of punishment, you want it to be over quickly and forgotten once it's done. It's for the present, Hebrews 12 says. But praise can be posted on the refrigerator and left there until it kind of turns to papyrus, you know, because it's a good thing and it's something that helps. And it's continual and consistent. Okay. Here's a checklist that you can think about that kind of implements some of that. All right. So we're not quite to the infraction yet. My question to ask, though, we are at the infraction. It just happened. Something bothers me. Is the rule or the desired behavior clear and observable? That'd be a question I would ask. Do they know the rule? And I'll tell you, when the experiment looks like this, they know the rule. They've shown that they understood there was something wrong about what I'm doing. So they'll watch for that. But there may be in their older years, you could say, do you know the rule, right? They could actually maybe repeat it. And there may even be a consequence that they know and they remember. Yes, I know. I get a spanking whenever that happens. They may even know that. Is the disobedience obvious and known and admitted? In other words, it's for sure they did it. Is it willful with evidence of rebellion, laziness, disrespect, stubbornness, or whatever the foolishness parameter is? It's got to be attached with that. Okay, so now I answer yes to all of those things. I think an interlude might be a good thing. And I'm thinking of the trumpets in Revelation and the bowls of wrath, right? Let's have an interlude, maybe a discussion with spouse that says, am I calm? Do I appear calm? Because I don't want to do this I don't want to be showing anger in the moment I do this punishment, whatever it is. I don't want to be showing. I'll come to a little bit more about why. Have I reviewed the rule, the disobedience consequence with the child? Have I expressed my love and explained that that's the motive of the punishment? Furthermore, I don't even like doing this. There's an interesting thing about the fact that I don't like doing this. I don't like doing it, but I have to do it anyway because God told me to do it. And you know, there may be some things in your life you don't like to do, like this thing we're talking about right here and this punishment, but you have to do it. And this is one of those things for me. I don't like it. And maybe it's obvious that I don't like doing it. So now there's a punishment. Afterward, I express confidence that my child is capable of better behavior. I've expressed and demonstrated willingness to forgive, including physical touch. And if you've gone through this before, even in somewhat abbreviated form, you know this is an emotional moving moment. In some ways, the after effect is as bonding as anything can be on the positive side. Okay, I'm going too fast, but I hope this means something to you. It's a good checklist to say, here's a way to know when to punish. Now, I'm skipping over that. I want you to know what the experts say in this hostile world we live in. The American Association of Pediatrics says this. There is perhaps no more controversial form of discipline than spanking. The American Academy of Pediatrics disapproves of spanking under any circumstances. I want you to know that. And they're going to explain the obvious reasons why. Here are some reasons why we encourage parents to avoid spanking. Number one, spanking teaches children that it's okay to hit when they're angry. I heard a comedian a while ago, he was kind of telling the story. He was kind of joking about all the spankings he got when he was a kid, and now you can't do that. He thought that was funny. And he said, you know what they say? If you hit kids, it teaches them to hit other kids, you know? And he said, that can't be true. They already know how to hit other kids. And he has a point. Right? I mean, they know how to hit and grab things that aren't theirs and all that. That's not the lesson they're learning. But are we hitting them when they're angry? When we're angry, I mean? Is that it? We just said, don't be angry. This is not an exercise of wrath. Okay? I don't know. Do not spank in anger. Spanking can physically harm a child. Okay? That Proverbs told us he will not die, so don't physically harm them. All right? It seems to me that this last one down here, in the case of children who are looking for attention by acting out, that may inadvertently reward their behavior by giving them attention, and that's negative, but they like it. But maybe negative attention is better than no attention at all in their mind, right? Seems to me, why wouldn't you say that about any punishment? You know what I mean? Maybe time out is somehow ignoring them, but it seemed to me that any unpleasant thing, right, in some ways is rewarding. Say, you know, I know you're still here. And I think about Absalom when he came back, and he could not get his dad's attention. Remember that David wouldn't meet with him. You remember what he did? I can't remember exactly. He like set fields on fire or something, didn't he? Is that right? Yeah. So, I mean, it's like he wanted attention. That's what he wanted. And I think sometimes kids do want that. And maybe they do act out to give the attention, right? That doesn't mean you change the rules of the punishment. Maybe you figure out what their needs are and satisfy those for time with dad or for comfort if something in their life isn't right and they don't even know how to express it except in a way that looks like rebellion. Maybe that's what you do. Anyway, so just so you'll know. I'm not going to cover this. I had a chart which I'm not going to cover that either. Too much. Okay, we're not doing any of that. I had a thing which was what are reasons not to punish, but I think you know what those are. We can list a few. What are some reasons not to punish children, but we want to? They annoy us. This is a way to get them off my nerves, is to get them quiet down. It's actually better if they're kind of crying in the corner than if they're yelling in the foreground, right? That's one thing, right? What's another reason sometimes we might punish?
They've embarrassed us.
They've embarrassed us, right? They blurted out a family secret in public, right? Or that's not. But, you know, they are acting out in a way that really breaks the rules, but I'm not doing anything about it except for now because I'm so embarrassed. Is it ever the case we want to show how good of parents we are by showing off our discipline in front of others and only then, yes? Okay, or anything that hurt me in some way. This inconvenienced me. I have to clean up this milk for the third time, and I'm just tired of that. And now I am teaching negative lessons. Do you see that? That when somebody hurts me and inconveniences me, that's when I strike back. It has nothing to do with their moral character or a love for them or desire to make them better. It's you've inconvenienced me. That is a true negative lesson, I have to say. It is folly demonstrated by parents as opposed to the other way around. Yeah, these are good. These are all not the right reasons for discipline. Okay. Would you do one last thing? I'm going to stop. It's not a great crash, slam, bang ending, but that's where we are to end this thing. I wish you would go to the very back page, and let's try one more time on these verses. So at least you can say you learned where some things were in the Bible. We can do them right quick. Let's try it right quick. Same fast, we'll get done quick. Reasons for a man and his wife to be called one flesh at marriage. Two, one flesh, divorce is wrong. Matthew 19. Jesus contrasts Gentile greatness with greatness in the kingdom. Didn't cover that. One flesh, proving that fornication is wrong. Six, God, Christ, man, woman, headship, chain. 11. Women to keep silent, the churches and other guidance for orderliness. Okay? Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. One flesh, you know the next three, Ephesians 5, because you remember that from before. Fathers not to provoke their children to wrath. Husbands not to be bitter toward their wives. Good. Fathers, okay, that's the same thing, you remember that. Women not to teach or have authority over a man. Based on reasons that come from both before and after the fall. Remember that. Qualifications of elders and deacons. Younger widows. First Timothy, actually the chapter is about older widows. Widows indeed primarily, but anyway, that's yeah. Qualification of elders. Older women teach younger women. Titus 2. Wives submit to non-Christian husbands. Husbands dwell with their wives according to knowledge. Verse Peter 3. The proto-deacons are selected based on their character qualifications, not their ability to serve tables. Consequences of the fall on both men and women in their relationship. Worthy woman described. Purpose of discipline is to drive out folly. Yeah. The ideal shepherd, 34. Discipline is painful in the present. Unfortunately, we didn't really spend much time. Gifts in the church, in the body, in the individual. Men lift up holy hands without wrath and disputing. 1 Timothy 2. Elders who watch in behalf of our souls. The lucky chapter. Discipline of, sorry, got that. Believing men and women not to divorce because they might save their spouse. 1 Corinthians 7. Okay. These were our objectives. Can you do any of these? Pick these at random? I don't know. I'm not sure I did a good job on getting these factual learnings here. Can you explain the implications of the humanistic worldview on child rearing? Maybe. These are for tomorrow, 23 through 28. We'll do those in the morning. Explain Proverbs 22:15 using the definition of folly from the Proverbs. Can you do that? All right, I'm done. Stephen, let's have a prayer and go rest. Amen.